Well, let's first get approve the prior commission minutes. Let's get that out of the way. For
February
19th. Is there a motion to adopt the minutes?
I move.
So Representative Murphy moves adoption of the February 19th minutes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. We have a number of items on the agenda today, and I know we have a number of people here. That's why we moved to a different room, which is larger to accommodate members of the public who may not have been seeing and tracking some of the things we've been doing over the last couple of months. This is not the first time we've been looking at the major funds. This has been a work in progress. This is the first time we've actually had the proposals, the bills before us, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're not going to repeat some of the basic information that we've already been given to the Pensions Commission about the long-term prognosis of some of the funding. I've asked the fund director to just kind of summarily remind us of what those numbers are, but we're not going to go in depth. We've already done that in this commission. Just to kind of give you a flavor of what, you know, some of the things we've already been told is that in law, there's a variety of factors that affect the long-term viability of the pension funds. One is that we assume that over a period of time, they're going to have sufficient investments that are going to, help cover the fund. And we've had an assumption of 8.5% interest rate returns. That has been unrealistic in the recent past. Just as recently as a week ago, this commission was told by our own actuary that you'd have to have 19% interest rate on your returns over a three-year period to keep from falling behind. If you want to spread it over a five-year period, that would be about a 15% interest rate. Or if you want to go 12 years, that would be about 10 years would be about a 12% interest rate. And at the moment, nobody really thinks that's realistic, but that's what you need to keep from losing ground on, you know, just on investments. Other factors that have happened over the years, in the 90s, when the economies was white hot, when the funds were all doing well, we had a number of issues brought to us that people were saying that benefit increases have not been keeping up with inflation. So we tried to address that. We built in some benefit increases that in the long range are going to be costing more and more money because, among other things, more people are living longer. We also reduced, in some cases, contribution rates for the employer and employee, again, because the funds were doing so well. So these bills have to, you know, they're not easy, especially in troubled economic times, but, you know, this is always a work in progress to try to figure out, you know, what's the best long-run policy. What is absolutely clear, and we've been told this over and over, is that delaying it makes it worse. The hole gets deeper if you don't do anything. So it's up to the commission what they want to do with these issues. But the major funds have already told us we're going to be looking at their bills, that there's a combination of things that are going to be similar and there's going to be differences with each bill. You might see some employer and employee contribution increases. Employer contribution increases means the governments. For TRA as an example, or Duluth teachers or St. Paul teachers, I can't think of any school districts that's going to be able to find the money within their budget to pay for it. If you're talking about PERA, you're talking about the city and county governments, and they're going to have to find a way to get the money or raise property taxes, do something. For the employee contribution increases, that's painful. I don't think a lot of the public quite understands that public employees do have to fund their own pensions, you know, at least in large part, and that they're going to have to pay more under these proposals for that without necessarily getting more. It depends upon how this all shakes out here. And in cases, in some employees, they've had very little or no pay increases, so a employee increase would actually translate to a pay cut for some people. That's not easy to do. We've heard proposals that are going to be in these bills about limits on cost of living increases. Social Security had a 0% increase, I think, for this two-year period, so this kind of replicates some of that. Again, it's not easy or right, but that's just some of the things that we're having to look at. Also, we've been paying a good interest rate on deferred annuities for people who don't want to take their pension early on or when they're due to. But rather than paying a higher interest rate, we're trying to pay a little bit of a lower interest rate. You're going to hear more details if you don't already know them, but So we've already been advised of the framework of what is coming before us today, but we're going to be actually taking a more detailed look at the bills as we have before them. What I plan to do here is to bring up the major bills one by one and talk about them. And there's a couple of bills on the agenda that may interact with them. For instance, MSRS has their proposal, which also there's a MSRS has one that here's PERA. They've got an issue with police and fire that we may need to consider. TRA also has a teacher benefit increase issue. So to the extent that we've got related issues on the agenda, we'll try to look at them as we look at each fund. So why don't we start with the MSRS proposal? Let's start with them and have MSRS explain to us just what the proposal does and how it ties into how they see that this is going to help the long-range stability of their plan. Mr. Bergstrom, welcome back before the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And the three funds did put together a single handout, so we can fast forward through some of TRA. And if you would then look to page 6 of the handout that is going around. Mr. Chair, 3 years ago, the MSRS General Plan, which is by far our largest plan, was about 95% funded. I never imagined having to be here to discuss this proposal to lower benefits. A year ago in March, the market had bottomed out, and we were down about 30% for the fiscal year. And we received hundreds of calls from people concerned about losing their deferred compensation plan accounts, about losing their pension, and not getting their checks. And that was a very sobering time for us in the pension business. And that sense of panic among our membership was very frightening. The proposal today is not one of panic, but a necessary step to move the MSRS funds back to financial stability. The board is committed to making sure retirees, deferred members, and active members can count on their pension, and the board's had to make some hard decisions. The proposals I'll be discussing today will have a positive financial impact on MSRS funds in the neighborhood of $70 million in the first year, which will grow in future years. So if you look on page 6, and Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments of introduction. Won't spend a lot of time maybe on the first chart, and then the rest will fall in place. If you look at our actuarial value, MSRS still looks really great at 86% funded, but that does not recognize all of the losses that we had over the last 2 years. If you look at what we are in a market value as of July 1 of 2009, we were 65.61% funded. I will say that this fiscal year we've had a decent return. I am guessing that our market value today is about 70%. But we still have a long way to go to get back towards 100% funding. On an actuarial basis, our current contributions are 10. Market value, that doesn't change. The actuary says we need 11.5% actuarially, which would leave us 1.5 short. On a market value, 16.25%, which would leave us on either contribution rate or benefit cut change 6% short. The contributions for this plan as of July 1 of 2010 will be 5% employee and 5% employer. And I would like to remind you that employees and employers have both, over the last 4 years, increased their contributions from 4% to 5%. And we have been phasing those in. When we look at the suggestions that MSRS is proposing, and that would be on the next page in Senate File 2573, House File 2952. The MSRS board is proposing lower future post-retirement increases from 2.5% to 2%. That would generate a savings on a contribution rate of 0.9%. We are looking at delaying just the initial post-retirement increase. That is something that we had moved forward this past year. We're looking at going back to where we were 2 years and prior. That has an impact of about 0.1%. We have We are looking at lowering the interest paid for state employees who have left state government and will someday collect. And this would apply to current people that have left and all current employees as well. Under current law, we increase their pension by 3% until age 55 and 5% thereafter. The board is proposing to just set that at a fixed 2% rate. That has a cost savings of 0.5%. The actuary has done a four-year analysis, and we need to make some assumption changes, particularly in the salary growth expected for state employees. It has been, the actuary has been assuming much higher salary increases than reality, and they are recommending a pullback, and that has a savings from an actuarial basis of 0.9%. We are also proposing to eliminate interest on accounts for retirees who leave, retire, and then come back to government. Under our current law, if they hit $14,600, I believe that's the amount, we suspend their benefit, we hold them in arrears a year after they terminate again, we give them back what we held, we now pay 6% interest, and we're proposing to eliminate that interest. Those are immediate savings impacts for us. We are also looking at savings that will help us in the future. One is increasing vesting from 3 years to 5 years of service. The other piece is that we will naturally save money going forward as we phase out the people hired before 1989. The actuary assumes their higher benefit, their higher liability, and as that group moves out over time, we will save as the group now has lower benefits, and that accounts for about 0.8%. Cumulatively, we are looking at a saving, or it's a reduction to our liabilities of 3.5%. The actuary said we needed 1.5. That would give us a cushion of about 2, but you could see it would still leave us a deficiency from a market value of 2.75. The reason we felt we did not need to fully fund to the market value, we do expect a rebound at some point. We have seen the beginning of that this year. We also are recognizing savings kind of from things that are happening naturally as well. Fewer state employees are retiring fairly dramatically, and they pay in longer and collect for a shorter period of time. The zero salaries that state employees have taken saves us considerable money because high fives don't grow as quickly. And so what our board's goal was to level out sort of the funding line, then let the recovery get us back to 100% funding. If you look graphically on the next page, and this assumes 8.5% interest. Blue line shows where we are headed.
What page?
Mr. Chair, it's the page after. It would be page 8.
Okay.
Not sure it shows up. Sure. And there are just three lines. The bottom line is current. If we do nothing, it shows MSRS dropping fairly dramatically over time. The red line shows the immediate savings that we are proposing. And the green line represents kind of what would happen with the future savings as well. So dramatically what we have done is improve the funding. We already know we have somewhat of a recovery. Hopefully we will hold that. And we do expect some significant savings going into the future as well.
According to this graph that you've just pointed out to us, If we do nothing, then by 2038, the fund would be 20% funded. Is that an accurate reading?
Mr. Chair, yep, I believe it's about 18%.
Okay. And even with all the proposals that you're making here, the best case scenario is, you know, as we sit here today, by 2038, it would be about 57%?
Mr. Chair, that's about, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, the question is, if we just do nothing this year and just wait to see how things are going to look next year, what happens?
Mr. Chair, if we come back next year, nothing much will have changed from the chart. We would have missed an opportunity to realize some savings. The financial look will not improve. If you numerically, what will happen is our actuarial funding will go down from 85 to the low 80s. We really would be missing an opportunity to get this done. And we will be back here with a more costly proposal, and eventually this needs to be done. Our board did not bring this lightly. They made very painful decisions, and we feel strongly from a pension plan that we need to move ahead in order to stabilize the funds.
And what happens if the economy gets much better between now and a year from now? How does that change anything?
Mr. Chair, as you highlighted, the needed returns to, I think you said, 3 years at 19%. That's just to break even. Let's take a worst-case scenario or a best-case scenario. Let's say we have great market returns and things improve. We would be smiling on our face, coming up and saying we're wrong, and we could back off what we've done. But if what happens is what we expect and you don't make the change, we are sitting at a very serious chance of default. So let's say things all of a sudden steam ahead, we can come back and modify. Our post-retirement change triggers back on at 90%. But the pain of not doing anything and even seeing, let's say, another drop in the market would be one that I don't think we would want to take.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bergman, how do you define default?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, in Mr. Martin's memo, it has the proposed dates of running out of money. And default would be not having a penny left to pay retirees. And I believe for MSRS general plan, it was in the 2030 or 2040 range. And by default, I have it here. So in his chart on page 5 of the memo, it has our judge's plan defaulting on 2023, state retirement, state patrol plan 2029, general plan 2039, and correctional plan 2036. And that is what our retirees are concerned about, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, is running out of money.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, the one thing I would like to be optimistic about is that we're going to have a changing government in that period of time, and maybe we'll get some sense of a government that's more reasonably willing to look at some sources of revenue rather than just spending cuts. And if that happens, we've got a lot of period. Any time in that period, we've got a lot of time to fix this. I understand how it's getting worse, but as I look on this graph and on page 8, I guess it is, you know, it doesn't really start to get significantly worse until, 2015, 2016 or something like that. And so maybe we'll get some sense of responsibility of the populace in understanding what our responsibilities are instead of on the federal level and the state level just being able to push them aside.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that is a risky avenue to go down. I think if we look at historically, dealing with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, where we talked and talked about for years and nothing was done.
Okay.
We talked about the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, and the last thing that our board can live with is not giving retirees a sense of security.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Berg, the huge difference between an open fund, I mean, if we believe that governments as it is going to totally collapse, that's essentially the comparison that you'd make to a closed fund. I mean, a closed fund is there's no money going into it. An open fund has a certain amount of money going into it at all times. And so, you know, on the short term, you're going to be able to make I mean, there are certain things that I think are so long term that we can't ignore. I don't want to pick on Duluth, but it was the first thing in front of us, which is I think any proposal to lower the normal retirement age, if you look at any demographic proposals in the real world, that would go off the table so fast that it doesn't even get on the table. And, you know, I think lives have just changed. And that's, as you said, people are making that decision by themselves that they're not going to retire for various reasons. But I think we shouldn't put any kind of encouragement to anybody that that may happen at any time. And in fact, again, looking back at MRF, one of the really bad things that happened to this to that fund, and that was unilaterally the problem of the Minneapolis city government, was a dramatic putting in of some very good benefits for early retirement on this ground, this false declaration that when you fire people with seniority and you hire new beginning people, you make a big salary savings. Well, you do, and if the cost goes, you don't have to pay the cost. It just goes to the pension fund, then it's great for you. But I think we have to understand these things, and we have to understand, you know, that we have a different kind of employment picture on now and a different kind of life expectancy period, and we've got to understand those kinds of things.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, the MSRS proposal does not increase benefits. And the Minneapolis Retirement Fund was an open fund. And I believe very strongly that we just cannot take the risk. And I look at the budget projections for the next couple of years, and I don't see a lot of rosiness in those. If that ever happens, we can come back and undo these things. And when there is money, we've got a lot of pent-up need to improve roads and schools and other things that will be, and pensions would be part of that. So, Mr. Chair, we feel a need to move ahead. And
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, how comfortable are you at the annual increase at 2%?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we clearly would have preferred to keep it at 2.5%. We think 2% provides an increase. Inflation has been low. Our retiree organization actually supports our proposal because their view is that making sure they have a pension is primarily is their primary function, and we would feel the same. I don't know what inflation will do, but when it comes all said and done, getting an increase over potential of losing pensions is a decision that needs to be made.
Mr. Chairman, Mr.
Murphy.
What if it was up to 2%?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I could certainly take that back to the board for consideration. I would like to circle back with our retiree organization as well.
Did you discuss it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we did have a discussion of that as well. And you know, the board, we had a fixed 2.5, went to the 2. And again, I'd be happy to bring it back and talk to the stakeholders again as well.
You may have to move your mic a little closer, too. Hit the mic. Yeah. Sarah Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Kahn that we can't go down the early retirement road, but I really feel that we should not delay. The economy is not projected to recover for 3 to 5 years. We know that jobs and income lag behind that. I think delay is just going to be more expensive to the fund, and the most important thing is to preserve the fund. I think that we should freeze COLAs. I think St. Paul teachers demonstrated they froze their COLA and they saved $17 million. We should tie COLAs to inflation after the freeze. And I just think we have to be very, very conservative because it seems like very fast. It was a very short time ago that some of these funds were fully funded. And they fell very, very fast. And I think we all should be very, very nervous. The most important thing is to preserve the integrity of the fund. And if we have to forego, everybody is suffering. Nobody's getting increases. It's better to keep people employed, keep people in their pensions, than give people little 1% and 2% increases.
So, Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to say, just in response to Representative Kahn's comments, too, that, you know, unfortunately, none of us has a crystal ball in terms of what might happen in the future in terms of our leadership's view toward toward revenue. But if we did have a leader with a different view there, we know that there are going to be pent-up pressures from so many different directions competing for limited, very limited dollars. As has been mentioned here, all of the projections are for a very slow recovery. And so it seems to me that if we're looking at this as kind of a fiduciary responsibility to making sure the fund continues as it is, I don't want to point any fingers at any particular people, but, you know, some people have talked about a defined contribution plan. And so that wouldn't necessarily mean the government explodes and doesn't exist. It means that there could be a very dramatic change to pension benefits with a closed fund, which would put us in a much worse position. And so so if we were to consider delaying, especially not knowing whether the situation might get better or worse in terms of someone's future attitude toward this, I think we should know, like say we waited till 2015, what would be the additional cost and what potential situation might we be in if we took that kind of risk?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we could certainly look at sort of what would happen if we waited until 2015. I know from MSRS's standpoint, we are looking at a total reduction or increase to our financial strength of about $70 million a year. As things go, we would need much more than that into the future. I'd be happy to provide that. I don't have it with you. But we would have lost, just sort of mathematically, 5 years of $70 million. That's $350 million. And who knows what returns we would have gotten and what would have happened. The other thing that I think that is really critical is people get it today. People understand because the markets are down. People understand because they've read the paper. And let's say we have a 19% return and everybody thinks everything is rosy. We're still going to be coming in and doing this because it's not good enough for what we need. So I think it's an opportune time to do it because everybody is feeling the pain. It's not fun. It's not fun being here today. I just don't think we can afford to miss the opportunity.
Senator Olson, and members, this hearing is being televised, so to the extent that you've got a microphone in front of you, please speak into it. I'll speak as loudly as I can with what voice I have, but you need to use the microphone. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Bergstrom, I'm not an investment expert, too, but it strikes me that if we do have an optimistic view of what might happen with returns, then we'd want to maximize our ability to have take advantage of that growth, whereas if we don't maximize that opportunity, not only will it cost us more having lost those returns, but we would have to buy in at a higher value and have missed the opportunity to take advantage of those gains if they come.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I could not agree more. Any money going into the plan, any money saved, when the markets recover, that's more money to earn that return on, and you're absolutely correct.
Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a more of a technical question. Why do we actually get savings from recognition of post-89 hires? Why aren't they already built into the projections?
Ms. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we use a closed group actuarial, and our actuary is here if you want more detail. But it kind of looks
probably
at,
not.
Okay. How do I know I'm on TV? I got to go put my makeup on too. I don't know. They look at the group, and they don't necessarily build in future hires. So they look at who they have, the liabilities that they have, and as that group moves out over the next 10 years. Our normal cost will go down, which will end up saving us some money.
Okay, so it's just not built in right now. Okay, all right, thanks.
Okay, members, we've got a spreadsheet that kind of summarizes each bill. In just a moment, I'm going to ask Mr. Martin to just tell us the particulars about the MSRS bill. As I say, we're going to do that for all the major funds. Senator Lynch, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up on a comment that Senator Pappas made And for purposes of the discussion in our pension principles, number 7 talks about the adequacy of benefits at retirement. And I think for this discussion, it'd be helpful if we would reference 7A, which says benefit adequacy requires that retirement benefits respond to changes in the economy. And so on the discussion of whether or not we act now or we wait, I think that our pension principles can give us some good counsel in that area.
Thank you. There's been a couple of references to the fact that there's going to be a new administration next year, and who knows what's going to be in the legislature. There's 3 members on this commission who've been here for the current administration, and all 3 have chaired this commission, as Representative Murphy, Representative Smith, and myself. And just speaking for myself, the administration hasn't shown overly a great interest in pension issues, but they've not been an obstacle. You know, I mean, I don't think that they've done anything that hurt pension policies. What I fear is that if nothing happens, and if this becomes an issue in the upcoming elections, it could wind up getting worse from a political standpoint. So, but I don't think that I just want to make it clear that, you know, this administration has not been a problem in pension issues. Obviously, when there's concerns, they've let us know that, but you know, they haven't hurt us in any way. Mr. Martin, did you want to tell us what's in the MSRS bill?
Members, if you turn to the large packet, item number 2 in your packets, and on top of the executive summary there is a single-page comparison of all of the various proposals on a legal sheet that's landscape-oriented. And the MSRS proposal is essentially the first half of the boxes that you see there. MSRS administers 6 plans that are affected by the Senate File 2573, House File 2952. That would be the MSRS General through the ESO columns. ESO is the Elective State Officers, the former Constitutional Officers Plan. The most affected plans by the proposal would be MSRS Correctional and State Patrol by simple number of boxes that are filled in. The least affected would be the Constitutional Officers Plan that has no active members, no deferred members, only a handful of our retired members. And we've run through the various types of benefit changes is along the left-hand grid. The post-retirement increases, member and employer contributions are the first item. MSRS is proposing contribution increases only for 1 plan. That's the State Patrol plan. It's an increase of 2% in the normal contributions to the plan and the addition of a 10% employer additional plan contribution. If you're interested in the dollar amounts, this would be a budgetary impact for the Department of Public Safety, DNR for the game wardens, and a handful of other agencies that have law enforcement personnel and state government. About $7.7 million annually. Post-retirement increases apply to all the plans. MSRS is proposing an increase from 2.5% to a decrease in the post-retirement adjustment rate from 2.5% annually to 2%. It would be restored to the 2.5% when the plan becomes fully funded. 90% funded on a market value basis. It also would impose a 6-month waiting period for the initial post-retirement increase. Current law, there are prorated increases with any length of retirement from month on. One of the differences between MSRS and the other plans is there's no proviso in the MSRS bill that once MSRS plans become 90% funded and then drop off of 90% funded, what happens? The post-retirement increases would continue under the MSRS proposal as drafted. There would be a going back to the reductions in the other plans. Interest on refunds is pretty consistent throughout the plans. A reduction in interest on refunds from the current 6% rate to 4% for the deferred annuities augmentation. This is the increase that's granted to to deferred annuities to try and maintain their purchasing power. It's been reset a few times in the past. It once was 5%. It's been reduced to 3% for most of the deferral periods, and was reset in 2006 at 2.5% for post 2006 employees. MSRS is proposing reducing that all to a 2% augmentation rate. For reemployed annuitant earnings limitation deferral account interest, it would be eliminated for the three plans that have a reemployed annuitant earnings limit. Vesting for new members in MSRS, MSRS Correctional, and State Patrol would be increased from the current 3 years to 5 years for MSRS General and for State Patrol. There's an incorrect, it's 10 years of service for MSRS Correctional, and that's a typo on the spreadsheet here. So it's for MSRS Correctional, the vesting for new hires after 2010 would be increased from 3 years to 10 years, not the indicated 5 years.
So under the column MSRS Correctional, if you go down to F, vesting service requirements, that box there, which is from 3 years, it should be, instead of 5 years, it should be to 10 years. Okay, thank you.
I apologize for the error.
Sure.
The early retirement reduction factor
I think so.
Is changed for the correctional plan and state patrol, and the benefit accrual rate for the correctional plan is are reduced for new hires.
Okay, and is there anything else about the bill's details or whatever that we need to know in understanding the MSRS proposal? This pretty much summarizes everything in the proposal.
Senator, yes, okay. With that one typo correction.
Sure. Mr. Bergstrom, there's one or two issues I think we need to figure out here. It looks like MSRS itself is not looking for contribution increases except for the state patrol plan, and it looks like you're looking for a 10% increase from the employers. I'm told that would be about $7 million. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. And over what time period are we looking for that $7 million?
Mr. Chair, in a perfect world, we would start it today. I've had some discussion with the Department of Finance and the departments, so I am still working on that. I understand clearly that this is a tough year budget-wise, and I would just like an opportunity to continue to work with them to reach some kind of a phase-in or some solution. We've had some positive discussions, but certainly haven't resolved anything, and very well aware of the budget issue.
Now, the judge's plan is under MSRS, and it appears that they might start falling behind in reaching their actuarial goal of being 90% funded. And I think it's fair to say if there's any group that, you know, will likely challenge what we're doing in here because they have some constitutional protections that nobody else has, that's the group. So are we creating any problems with the judge's plan and how they're being funded down the road?
Mr. Chair, we are proposing that the judge's cost of living adjustment be reduced from 2.5% to 2%. That saves a 1.7% of pay. The Judges Association did mail out a packet to their retirees, and I received seven or eight emails from them all in favor of the proposal. That doesn't mean they all support it, but I have not heard from one judge or retired judge opposing the change. Mr. Chair, you are right that this plan still may need some more work. Just a little history, this plan didn't start to become pre-funded, I believe, in 1990 or 1991, sometime in that time frame. Up to that, it was pay-as-you-go. So it's always lagged behind because it started out from such a low position. We will continue to watch it. The courts are paying a fairly high employer share to pay off the unfunded liability, and we do think as the markets recover, that will help stabilize as well.
Mr. Bergstrom, one of the goals that we had back in 1997 was try to get the three major funds, MSRS, PERA, and TRA, as uniform as possible. Now, are we deviating from that with what we're proposing here? We haven't looked at the other two proposals yet, but we did want to have some consistency here.
Mr. Chair, we are deviating from that. We have deviated from that in the past. The teacher's formula going forward is 1.9%. Our funding ratios are different. Our contribution rates are different. And our board feels very strongly responsible for the MSRS plans and want to do what's right for them. So we have deviated. Back in 97, we put together a package to try to fund Minneapolis teachers, to adjust a lot of different things. I was part of that. Life has changed. Times have changed. We're all in different scenarios, in different situations right now.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm so used to sitting in this committee room with Senator Berglund sitting there that it's just kind of an automatic.
Not Senator Berglund, okay.
No. Mr. Bergstrom, just for clarification purposes, the column that has to do with legislators would apply to legislators who are retired now and legislators that came in after or before 1997. Is that correct? Because I don't think the rest of us aren't in a traditional pension plan. We're in a 401k type of plan, so this wouldn't apply to us?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, this would apply to the legislators who were pre-97. They, too, would get a lower cost of living adjustment. You are in the unclassified plan. You could, if you wanted to, convert that to monthly benefits, and if you did, you too would receive lower cost of living adjustments going forward.
Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, I wondered if you could provide us a little bit of background on the post-retirement adjustments. And my question sort of, I'm trying to balance, I see that you are proposing to reduce the post-retirement adjustments. And I'm trying to balance that with how do we justify or deal with the fact that some of our active members are not receiving increases? Some of our active members perhaps are losing their jobs. And this is not a situation, I would point out, that's unique to public employees. In fact, it's happening in the private sector as well, only we often don't hear about that private sector discussion in a committee meeting like this. But did you have some discussion among your memberships, and how do you address that and justify
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, we had discussion about that. I have concern about tying the post-retirement increases to raises and non-raises. For example, let's say the economy improves and state employees, hopefully someday we'll get a makeup, or public employees, and they get a 5% raise. Our retirees won't get that. We took a long-term approach. We took a smoothing type approach rather than an approach of let's drop it down to zero. We just felt that slowing the growth was the right thing to do, because it's a permanent reduction in their base, not a reduction in their base, but it just doesn't grow as quickly. And we did not want to take a short-term approach and say, okay, look, at nobody's getting raises, so we're going to drop it to zero. Likewise, that would increase the pressure when there are big raises in our, and we've never done that.
Okay, Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, I'm going to follow up. Do you have data that would show if, rather than moving from 2.5 to 2, if you went from 2.5 to 0, what impact that would have on the funds?
Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, actually, if you did a permanent zero or a 2-year suspension.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, a suspension.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, a 2-year suspension would save 0.2% of pay, where the reduction, long-term reduction to a 2% saves 0.9% of pay.
Both. You want to do both.
Okay. Members, what I'm thinking of doing is just hearing. I know there's a number of members of the public here and interested parties who want to testify as to each fund. I think it'd be more efficient to hear from each fund first to get the layout of what their bill does, then back up and start looking at the other issues that people want to raise. Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, just one more clarification just so the public is clear. The reason there's blank boxes on some of these is because those provisions don't exist in those certain plans, so we're not treating people differently, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, exactly. Using the judges, for example, they don't have deferred augmentation.
Yeah.
We get, they're just, it's not an issue.
I just wanted to make that clear. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Mr. Martin.
Members, there are instances where the box is empty because that benefit provision does not exist. However, things like vesting service does exist. Our reduction rates do exist. Contributions do exist. So it's not true in all cases. There are some cases where it does not exist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen to that, and Mr. Martin's correct, but for example, legislators hired before 97, vesting isn't an issue. Judges, I believe, have 5-year vesting already. The early retirement penalty for judges is already a 6% per year reduction. So, a lot of the provisions that exist really didn't need changing.
Anything else from Mr. Bergstrom and MSRS? Okay, as I say, let's hear from PERA next and then TRA after
Mr. Chairman,
that. I'm sorry, Senator Pappas.
Before Mr. Bergstrom leaves, I think that what Senator Lynch and I were talking about is a two-year or even a 3-year zero COLA freeze, and then implement your plan to do the 2% until 90% funded. So then would that save 1.1%? Would you add the two together then, the 0.9 and the 0.2?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we would. And I appreciate, your willingness to look at other alternatives. From our retiree organization standpoint who supported this, I may lose some of the support. I don't know what my board would support there as well. We have somewhat of a delicate balance here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be interesting. Is that the impact that would have on your unfunded liability then, that amount? It could improve that as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, without a doubt, a 3-year freeze would add on to what we are proposing. I will tell you the other concern that our board had with a freeze, and I know others are proposing it, and I respect that and I understand that. One of the concerns that we have would be sort of this notch effect. You all have heard about the retirees that have received the big increases, and then you would have people who've retired recently who have the 2 or 3 year freeze, and then the people that retire after them are not going to have a 2 or 3 year freeze. And in essence, what you have is sort of a little dip there that you will likely hear about for a long time. And the board spent a lot of time talking about a freeze versus a permanent reduction with a trigger back at 90%. One of the reasons we went with the steeper reduction, again, is our fund from a funding status was not as bad off as others. We saved more money over the long term by saving the 0.9 rather than going to this other. And that was something that went in. I'm not saying that others are wrong. It's just what went into our thought process.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Let's take a look at the PERA proposal. Ms. Vanek, would you come forward? And again, members, I do have members of the public and interested parties who asked to testify. I want to get the overview of each plan first, and we'll circle back and if anybody's questions still need to be addressed, they will have an opportunity to do so. Ms. Vanek, welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mary Vanek. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you again today. I won't go at length into why we are here before you, because Mr. Bergstrom did a good job of covering that. The one thing I would like to differentiate is that in my 13 years as executive director, I think I've spent 11 of them in front of you with one issue after another. And absent the recent market condition, I was hopeful I wouldn't be back, at least not this soon. And I appreciate all the support you have provided to PERA and the Board of Trustees in helping us do the right thing to keep our plans on track. We would have been right where we predicted we would have been but for this situation. So here we are again, and we are going to be proposing changes in the same elements of the plan structure as the other two systems, but just different results because of our situation. Our slides begin on page 16. And just a quick refresher, our general plan is our largest plan. We have roughly 135,000 city, county, and non-teaching school district members in that plan. We have roughly 60,000 benefit recipients just from that plan. We are currently on an actuarial basis just under 70% funded at 69.99%, but on a market value basis as of July 1st, 2009, we were just under 53.8%. Our contribution deficiency, I'm going to take you down to the bottom of that chart, ranges from 2.7% to 6.7% shy. And this is after we have already asked the members in this plan to contribute an additional 1.25% of their pay over the last decade, and the employers to contribute 1.82% additional into this plan over the last decade. We appreciate the support we've gotten from them, because had they not stepped up and accepted contribution increases without any benefits associated with them, we would be in much worse shape today. And even though we're not a closed plan, we still need to be concerned about that funded level. The solution for the general plan was crafted in consultation with, or keeping in mind, what we wanted to do with our other two plans also. While the board was not focused on being uniform with MSRS and TRA, they did have a desire to stay uniform within our umbrella of plans that we administer. So the general plan is, we are proposing, actually for all plans, a change in our retiree annual adjustment from 2.5% to 1% until we are 90% funded. We are proposing eliminating deferred augmentation beginning January 1st, 2011, for all current deferreds. We are asking for a contribution rate increase, 0.25% each from our members and from our employers. We have assumption changes that we are asking you to adopt. We need to recognize the fact that people are living longer. We are the assumption changes include a reduction in our salary assumptions, because public employees in local government certainly aren't receiving the increases that we're currently projecting they will. And we also are projecting a lower payroll growth. That means our overall membership and their salaries will not be growing as we are predicting. The net result is an additional cost to the plan of 0.6% of pay. If all of these modifications are accepted on an actuarial basis, we would have roughly a 1.5% sufficiency. And it solves all but 2.5% of our market value deficiency. And as Mr. Bergstrom indicated, we expect, because salaries are being frozen and members aren't retiring as early as they generally have, that there will be savings realized there. And if we're all fortunate enough to see some market gains, we can hopefully work through that additional 2.5%, but we'll wait and see. We'll have to come back if we don't. On slide 18 is the picture of our general plan. If we do nothing, today we are 54% market value funded. If we do nothing and we make 8.5% for the next 20 years, we decline to 47% funded. That's the wrong direction. We're a little more stable than MSRS General and TRA because of the contribution increases we have recently enacted. 38% of our contribution revenue is already paying off the unfunded that existed before the market declined. So that puts us in a much more stable position. But it doesn't mean that we're going in the right direction if we just maintain the status quo. If you accept our modifications and we have some good returns, and we're being optimistic here, we're saying if we get 11% for the next 3 years, we have hopes of growing from 61% to 86% funded over the next 20 years. And we could get there much faster with other things that could happen in the meantime. But if we don't have positive results, we're certainly not going to experience that, and our other line is going to look worse. So we aren't any different than MSRS with respect to that. The board's proposal for the Police and Fire Fund is based upon the fact that on a market value basis, again, that plan is 63.55% funded. This is slide 19. That fund was over 100% funded not that long ago. And contributions were rolled back significantly because it had extra money in the bank to help support it. And with the contribution being less than the benefits were actually costing us, and the market taking away the extra money in the bank, we are now at a contribution rate that is higher than we ever expected in that plan, and the need is over 39% of pay on a market value basis. There's no way we can increase contributions to solve this plan if things don't improve in other areas. So with the 1% cost of living adjustment proposed in the Police and Fire Plan, slide 20, we have a reduction in the contribution requirements of 8.4% of pay. Again, the board is recommending, upon recommendation from the police and fire groups that we spoke to, an elimination of deferred augmentation, which saves us about 0.5% of pay, increasing contributions, which the membership of the Police and Fire Fund, the folks that I talked to, agreed to support, 0.2% from members, 0.3% from employers. So we have an impact on this contribution requirement of a positive 9.4% of pay. On a market value basis, we still have over 6% we have to make up. I have spoken to the police and fire members and said, we have more work to do on this plan. If things go well, we'll improve, but we still need to do some more work on the fundamental structure of the plan or additional revenue from some source to make sure we stay on track. On slide 21 is our, these lines have changed slightly because the actuary prepared some new numbers for us, and I didn't have her do a new projection. But roughly this gives you an idea of the trend. If we do nothing, we trend down from 63% market value funded today to 23% by 2038. By law, you want us 100% funded by 2038, so we're certainly going in the wrong direction. If we adopt the changes recommended by the board, we will end up at roughly 72% funded by 2038. It still doesn't go far enough, but again, the police and fire groups know that we need to do more work, so we have other things we'll be coming forward with in the future.
Representative Nelson.
And Ms. Vanek, no, just to get my mind straight, the police and fire, is that a coordinated plan, or is that they get Social Security?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, they do not.
Okay, that's what I
thought. They do not participate in Social Security. By law, they are not allowed to. Okay,
thank you. Ms. Vanek.
And then I will just touch quickly on the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association and the Professional Firefighters Proposal, Senate File 2672. The only difference in that proposal is that instead of the 1% fixed COLA, they are recommending an annual adjustment of inflation up to 1.5%. And on slide 22, that shows you that while if we get a few good years, we'd be at about 71% funded initially, we would trend down to under 60% funded with paying that higher COLA.
And we'll give them an opportunity to explain the proposal a little later, but
and then
that's some information.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have one more plan, and this plan, we're not proposing any changes other than those that flow through from the other plans. The correctional plan is only about 10 years old. It's been adequately funded for that period of time. It's about 95% actuarially funded, and it has a market value funding of just under 73%. The contributions on slide 23 are currently sufficient on an actuarial basis. They will trend to a negative 2% over time, but with the changes in the COLA and eliminating augmentation, there's a 3.5% of pay savings in that plan, so it really shores up that plan more than it really needs to be. This plan, we would expect, will get to 90% funded very quickly compared to the other two, and that would then give us a demonstration of how does that work when you trigger back the 2.5%. So in a smaller plan, it would certainly give us something to study and be aware of what we need to anticipate in the future. Mr. Chair, that's what we find in our bill.
And I'll have a description of the bill momentarily. And Ms. Vanek, again, could you reiterate it? If we do nothing this year, wait till next year, the consequences as you see them today.
Mr. Chair, if we do nothing again, as Mr. Bergstrom indicated, we lose an opportunity for some savings in the plans overall. By taking the positions that we're presenting, we do limit our growth in liabilities, and that amounts to, in the general plan, about $202 million a year, and in the police and fire plan, about $67 million a year, and that's without the contribution rate increases. That's just the benefit modifications. With the contribution rate increases, we give up $25 million in income in the general plan and about $4 million of income in the police and fire plan. And when you add all these pieces together, it has a real effect by delaying for a year.
So the hole gets deeper.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So
on the other hand, if over the next year things start getting a lot better, how does this affect your proposal?
Mr. Chair, again, I will refer to the Milliman report to you last year. Things need to be better 3 years in a row at 19% to just maintain where we are right now. We don't think where we are right now is something that we necessarily want to maintain. We want to see the lines go back upward and improve. So delay, you lose not only what we're projecting we will limit in our growth of liabilities and our income through contributions, but what you will earn on that.
Questions of Ms. Vanek? Mr. Martin, did you want to describe the bill and what's in particular note if the changes as opposed to MSRS? Ms. Martin.
Okay, members, if you look on the side-by-side chart, there are the three plans, PERA General, PERA Correctional, and PERA Police and Fire, are described there. There are contribution rate changes for PERA General and PERA Police and Fire. There's a reduction proposed in the post-retirement increases from 2.5% to 1%, restored when the plans become 90% funded on a market value basis, and a subsequent reduction if the plan does drop from 90% funded sometime in the future. There's a reduction in the interest on refunds. There's unfortunately another typo. The deferred annuities augmentation that's indicated here is from 5.3 or 2.5 to 2%. It should be to 1%. And again, I apologize.
For all three of those blocks?
For all three of those blocks.
Okay.
Amendment 1A that was just handed out, subsequent to putting together the bill, the PERA board decided to recommend the elimination of deferred annuities augmentation for these three plans. So the actual proposal that PERA has been talking about is a reduction in augmentation down to 0%, not the one you just wrote in. So one reflects the bill, zero reflects their current position, and that's reflected in the 1A amendment. An elimination of interest on the on the reemployed annuitant earnings limitation deferral accounts, and for and with respect to vesting for new members, increase in vesting for PERA General from 3 years to 5 years, and for police and fire and correctional, a shift from what's known as cliff vesting. That's 100% vesting when a certain minimum period of service is rendered, to a scaling up vesting system, 50% vested at 5 years, 100% vested at 10 years instead of the current 3-year vesting.
Okay, now, just so to be clear, this the 1A amendment that's been distributed is PRA's current proposal. It's, again, it may, you know, there may be some interest in changing it or whatever, but I at least this recommends what you're trying to propose to us. Is that correct, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, yes. In February, the board reconsidered the proposal to go to match our COLA with the deferred interest that we would pay going forward, and recommended and supported no augmentation after this calendar year.
Okay. Now, apparently there is some issues or discussion as to the proper COLA, which is the other bill we've got on the agenda. Is that correct? So
that's correct.
This is different from that. However, at least I think, members, we should at least put the bill in the shape the PRA wants it in, and then we can make whatever changes we want after that. So Representative Nelson moves the 1A amendment discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. And again, by adopting the amendment, that doesn't mean that we're adopting the policy. We're just putting the bill together as PRA wants to present it to us. Okay. Any questions of Ms. Vanek? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vanek, on the post-retirement adjustment, you're going down to proposing to go down to 1%. did you discuss going down to up to 1%?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we did not. We believe that 1% was already a pretty significant cut to what is already available to our retirees. And if inflation is lower than that, it's, you know, it doesn't make a significant difference. I can tell you, relative to the question that Senator Lynch asked earlier, we did look at a 2-year suspension. That would save us 0.5% of pay in the general plan, and it would save us 1.25% of pay in the police and fire plan. The board discussed a 2-year suspension followed by a 1.5% adjustment, but that did not reduce our costs as much as going to a 1% across the board. And the board really talked about the fact that if we conserve now, we have a good chance of getting back up there sooner. But if we don't conserve enough right now and things go south again, we have another dip into the recession or some worsening situations. With a plan that is 54% funded, we're not sure how we can correct it after the fact. That we'd rather have some protections in place with the hope of getting better faster than to be optimistic that it's going to work out and then it doesn't work out, and we have to figure out a way to maybe just zeros across the board or whatever. We haven't even ventured down the road to try to figure out how you'd solve the situation in a plan of our size.
Other questions, Ms. Vanek? Okay. If not, we'll move on to TRA. And again, I realize there are people here who want to testify on PERA's proposal, but I want to hear the major funds first. Members, as I'm trying to gauge the time and how much we can get done today, just as I'm looking at the people who want to testify, looking at the time to go through this, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get to Duluth or St. Paul teachers today. Now, the Duluth bill was just introduced, so it might need to stay out there for a few more days to look at. I'm told that there's an amendment in the works on St. Paul teachers, so it might be more appropriate, and again, to move into next week. But next week's is my plan to be the last meeting. So we got to get this stuff done, put together. So, Ms. Hecking, welcome back to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Laurie Hecking, TRA Executive Director. I'll be working off of the very beginning part of the handout that we had to you earlier. Just to briefly go over the numbers here, TRA, as it stands as of the last valuation, on an actuarial value basis, we stood at 77% funded. And working down that line with a deficiency of just over 5% of payroll. But as has been described to you earlier, that's a very misleading measure. We are focused on the last column, the market value column, because of the extraordinary drop in the market. That column is more instructive for planning our proposals going forward. So on a market value basis, we are 60% funded. That is the lowest that we have been in over 25 years. And just a few years ago, we were well over 100% funded in both our active and post-funds. So you can see what the market downturn has done to us. At the bottom there, it shows our current deficiency on a market value basis of over 11% of payroll, which is very large. If we were to try to solve that deficiency with contribution increases, we'd have to double our current contribution rates, which are 5.5% employee and employer. You asked earlier, a number of you, what happens if we wait? I actually have pretty precise numbers on this. By 2015, if we waited, our deficiency, instead of being 11% of payroll, would be 16% of payroll. So a very large increase, and that would mean that's equivalent to $200 million, meaning if we waited to 2015 to try to address this, it would be $200 million more costly to address. Under our proposal, which I'll go over in a minute, our deficiency is projected to steadily decrease. It would be in the range of about 6% of payroll by 2015. because we gradually and incrementally try to address it. So again, by virtue of our proposal, we would be saving about 9 to 10% of payroll off of what would otherwise be our deficiency. So those are very big dollars and show, they demonstrate the compounding effect of waiting to try to address this. If you could turn to the next page is a description of our proposals. Many of these are similar to what you've heard Ms. Vanek and Mr. Bergstrom describe. We differ somewhat. I'll start with the first line, which is to suspend the annual increase for 2 years, in January 2011 and 2012. This is different from the other two funds. There are some good reasons for this. First of all, TRA has a much larger deficiency than the other two funds have. We also have a very different demographic profile. We are a more mature fund, so our retiree liabilities loom much larger as a part of our liabilities, about 60 to 62%, whereas the other two funds, it's a lower percentage of their total liabilities. So unfortunately, we look to our annual increases for a good deal of savings in this proposal. The other reason we have a freeze in here is that we interacted quite a bit with our retirees about the proposals that we've developed, and you'll hear later our retiree organization does endorse this proposal, one of our retiree organizations. And their feedback was they preferred something more quick. Let's try to address this as quickly as possible and then get back to a normal situation. So their preference was to do something along the lines of this freeze rather than a deeper, longer-term cut, as some other proposals have shown. The second line there is we would modify the annual increase to 2% after 2012, starting in 2013. And that would remain there until the fund is stabilized. And there's an amendment a little later to put us in conformity with the other two systems. By stabilization, we're looking at a 90% market value measure. The third line is to increase contributions for employers by 2%. This would be phased in over 4 years gradually at 0.5% per year. I want to point out here that this employer rate increase, while it is significant, it is kind of getting us back to where we were historically. Through most of the 1980s and 1990s, our employer contribution rate was in the range of 8 to 9% until we did hit full funding in the late 1990s, and then that was dropped dramatically to 5. But it had been for close to two decades in the range of 8 to 9%. Another thing I want to emphasize here, we are not in this bill. There is no increase in school aid to offset the cost of this on the impact on school districts. Fourth line is a similar increase in employee contributions, again on the same schedule, phased in gradually over a four-year period of time. The next line is deferred interest, refund, et cetera. Those proposals have already been described to you, so I won't repeat it. We're pretty much identical to what, identical to what MSRS is proposing. We would still maintain a 2% deferred interest rate, unlike PARA, which is proposing to bring it to zero. But otherwise, those proposals are the same. In total, we expect revenue and savings from the proposal once they're fully phased in of 7% of pay. And compared to our 11% deficiency, we don't solve the whole thing, but we solve about two-thirds of it, hopefully. And we're optimistic that investment gains in the future will help us address the remaining. I want to emphasize here our board labored over these proposals for 6 months, 6 to 8 months, actually. We studied many of these options. The board settled on a proposal that tries to equitably distribute the sacrifice and responsibility for solving our problem, equitably distribute it between retirees, active teachers, and school districts. I think as a result of that careful work with our stakeholder groups, this proposal's been endorsed by 9 of the organizations, stakeholder organizations representing retirees, some active employees, not all, but some, and most of our employer organizations have endorsed, and you'll be hearing from them later. The next page just shows what happens if we do nothing. That's the purple and the green line. The purple line shows that our exhaustion date would be around 2032 using normal investment assumptions of 8.5% per year. The green line shows you much more optimistic assumptions, and it demonstrates that we really can't grow out of our problem, that we do need to take some steps to address it. The blue line is under our proposal. We would start to turn our negative line upward in terms of funding ratio and hopefully attain aiming for a 76% funding ratio by the end of this period. The red line just shows you under more optimistic assumptions, assuming we do have a rebound, we would be closer to 80% after that period. So, again, that's our proposal, and I would stand for any questions.
You did make a reference to a 1A amendment, and this is to your bill, which is Senate File 2499, House File 2953. Could you, again, just describe what this is, and this puts the bill in the shape that you want to proceed with it?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair. It would conform us with the other two systems in terms of the six-month reinstatement of the six-month waiting period for the COLA. That's lines 2 through 3. And lines 4 through 6 would put us on the same basis of restoring the COLA to a full COLA once we reach a 90% market value basis. Our bill had 80% actuarial value. They're actually roughly equivalent, but we thought it would be best to be in conformance with the other two funds.
Okay. Members, again, I think we should just put the bill in the shape that TRA wants to proceed with it. This doesn't mean we're adopting the policy, but at least they've got the bill the way they want it. So.
Mr. Chair, I'll move. Okay.
Representative Melson moves the 1A amendment. Discussion of that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Questions of Mr. Hacking? Sarah Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hacking, I just wanted to comment on the suspension that you have proposed. And I'm sure that that was a challenging discussion for your board to have, and a challenging discussion for all who are part of this plan. But I know that the active members of your plan, there are an inordinate number of them that are losing their jobs. And so I just, Senator Pappas is reminding me that not only are teachers losing their jobs in Minnesota, the teachers that are able to hold on to their jobs are doing so oftentimes with zero COLA. So thank you for your bold efforts here.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 2% employer increase, do you just have a number of what that would
be? Yes, Mr. Chair. In fact, the staff's memo has a good spreadsheet on that. Helping Mr. Martin, maybe you can help me here. It's on page 21 of the version I have. Is that still the case? Yeah, page 21 of the staff memo. You'll see a rundown.
Okay, thank you.
You see it there. And I might just caution you, Mr. Martin used the assumption that our payroll will be growing at 4.5% per year, which is currently the actuarial assumption. In reality, we're not seeing that kind of growth. We're seeing more to 2 to 3%. So this column listing of the impact is a bit overstated, probably, in reality, but it's close.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hear from a lot of people that are in that were in TRA that part of the problem is the merging of the fund with the Minneapolis Teachers Fund. Is any of the problems that caused by that, or is this market reductions or the market going down? And I guess I want it on the record if it is or if it isn't.
I think it's a variety of factors. Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, thank you for asking that question. Very clearly, it's the market impact. Had Minneapolis never been consolidated into TRA, we would still be here having to address a very, very large problem, as, of course, Minneapolis teachers would be here asking for some assistance. So had consolidation not happened at all, we would still have this serious deficiency. It is this extraordinary market decline that we've lived through.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hacking, the TRA has a three-year vesting period. Was that ever part of the negotiations of increasing it to the 5 years as some of the other funds have addressed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, our board did deliberate going to a five-year vesting period, and we prefer not to. The main reason is the typical sort of probationary period for teachers is about 3 years. And so we felt 3 years made more sense for our population. And in addition, because we're asking for significant contribution increases on the part of active teachers, we were trying to avoid having to reduce their benefit protection any more than what's already in the bill.
Okay, any other questions, Ms. Hacking? Mr. Martin, can you, I think she's, Ms. Hacking has kind of described what the proposal is, but could you kind of walk us through the TRA proposal?
Yes, members, if you turn again to the side-by-side comparison, you'll see contribution increases, a post-retirement suspension for 2 years, a reduction following that, a reduction in the interest on refunds, a reduction on deferred annuities augmentation, and the elimination of interest on the reemployed annuitant earnings limitation deferral account.
Okay, any questions on TRA?
Mr. Chair, just I think there may be just a typo on the COLA, the B.
Yes, members, there's a 1.5 that's indicated in your box, and that actually should be 2%.
Which line is it?
This is the item number B.
Okay.
That's the far right-hand second box down, inadvertently we got 1.5 and it should be 2%.
2%. Okay. Anything further from TRA? Okay, as I indicated, there's a number of people who wanted to testify, and what I'd like to do is go back into the order that we heard the presentations before we can compare and contrast the funds. We'll start with MSRS, and so if Mr. Bergstrom wants to come, you know, be near the table again, I have two people who wish to testify, or three people actually, Pete Obermeyer, Elliot Side, and Juby Blyle on the MSRS. And if there's anybody else who's here on MSRS, this would be the time to be heard on that. So if anybody wants to testify in MSRS, come on forward to the table and identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Pete Obermeyer. I'm here representing the Minnesota Retired State Employees Association, sometimes known briefly as MRSEA.
I'm Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm here to testify on both MSRS and PRA.
Okay. I suppose as long as you're here, you can probably do both at the same time. Let's hear from Mr. Obermeyer first. Mr. Obermeyer?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and members of the Commission. The organization MRSEA is an organization which represents Minnesota's retired state employees, as has been indicated by Mr. Bergstrom. We discussed the proposed changes in MSRS with his organization, which we appreciate. I want to start out by thanking everyone for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. We also wish to thank the board of directors of MSRS, TRA, and PERA, retirement funds, for the time and effort that they put into crafting the legislative proposals presented to the commission by the respective executive directors. Each fund proposal, it seems to us, reflects the unique funding issues facing the various individual pension plans. The Board of Directors and the officers of MRSEA have unanimously voted to support the legislative proposals submitted to the Commission by the MSRS Board of Directors and is now reflected by Senate File 2573 and House File 2952. I might add that the discussion that went into the passing of that resolution unanimously was spirited, to say the least. President Ruth Husum notified the chair in the commission, members of MRSEA's full support of the two bills, the Senate and the House file, by a letter dated February 5th, 2010. I have a copy of that letter with me if the additional copies need to be distributed, Mr. Chair.
Somebody will come and pick it up from you.
Okay.
Is it
Thank
just
you.
One copy? Or?
No, I have copies for
okay,
everyone.
Okay, somebody's going to pick it up from you.
And at that point, I wish to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the Commission members for the opportunity to appear here before you.
Hey, Peggy, go ahead and get it. Okay, any questions, Mr. Obermeyer? Okay, Mr. Side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 public and nonprofit workers who provide vital services and sustain the quality of life in Minnesota. On behalf of our members, I'm here today to reluctantly support SF 2573 and HF 2631. As you may know, our board originally urged the legislature to wait until next year to act on the legislation before you today. We had hoped that the economic recovery would happen at a faster pace, but as we've come to realize, this will be a slow recovery. We had hoped that investment returns would be enough to make up for losses in the markets over the past 2 years. Unfortunately, the revisions before you are needed to assure the sustainability of the funds. Yesterday, our board took a position to support passage of the necessary legislation proposed by the MSRS and PERA boards. Before I go further, Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out some important facts to the members of the Commission.
The average AFSCME retiree has pension benefits of about $13,000 a year. I'll repeat that, $13,000 a year. You don't get rich on $13,000 a year. You know what the benefit formula is. Nearly 92%, I believe it's actually 91% of retired public workers stay in Minnesota. That benefits our economy and keeps seniors self-sufficient. I would point out that Minnesota's public pensions serve a 500,000 persons. That's 1 in 10 Minnesotans. That 90%, as I said, 91% of public retirees stay in Minnesota. The systems pay out over $2.5 billion, add $3.3 billion to the economy, and create 22,500 additional jobs in our economy. State and local taxes collected exceed the public employer pension contributions by $80 million annually. The pension impact is larger than the gross state product from mining and 92% of agricultural, that's crop and animal production. That's key economic facts. And if you think about where the retirees live and the fact that many move from the metro area to greater Minnesota, that cuts in pension or eliminations of defined benefit or any such other items would have an adverse effect and a deteriorating effect, particularly in greater Minnesota where the economy is already in even a much more difficult situation than in the Twin Cities. More than 20% of senior citizens are living in poverty with only Social Security. And here's a key one for the Commission, Mr. Chairman. Minnesota taxpayers pay for only 15 cents of every dollar in public pension benefits. So our primary concern is the sustainability of the pension system in Minnesota. We have a fiduciary responsibility to protect the fund for our active members, retirees, and deferred members. Our members take this responsibility very seriously, as this is not the first time our board has stepped up to the plate. In the past few years, and I want to emphasize this, AFSCME Council 5 has supported increasing employee and employer contributions despite zeros, cutbacks, no steps, layoffs. We've supported a cap on the cost of living adjustment, the spreading of the contributions. We have taken every responsible step to make sure this fund is properly secured and that these deferred wages will be available when people retire. With a $1.2 billion deficit before this legislature and projected deficits for the upcoming years, unfortunately, we don't think conditions will improve quickly. And as I've said, our members have taken zeros, increases in health care premiums, out-of-pocket costs, layoffs, cutbacks, and increases in employee contributions to their pensions. Their average salary is $38,000 a year. Their public pension and Social Security make up the majority, if not all, of their retirement income. So the solvency of this fund is a priority for our members and retirees. The proposed legislation assures that the priority is sustained. And I would just add that we support the proposals as presented by PERA and MSRS. Any attempts to further decrease the benefits of our members in those situations will be vigorously opposed by our institution. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Are you here on MSRS? Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm Richard Kajewski, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. On behalf of our 12,500 members who belong to MSRS's general plan, we support the efforts and proposal put together and proposed by MSRS, their staff, and board of directors. We think despite its impact and the difficult decisions that were made to get us to this point, it's the responsible thing to do to stabilize the funds. So I'll leave my testimony real short, but we do support it.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to all the testifiers, you support the proposal as amended. Is that correct? Especially to you from, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Elliot Side from AFSCME.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, we support the proposals as presented by MSRS and PERA. Yeah. We have members in both funds.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
And we did not amend the MSRS proposal at all. The PERA and TRA ones had amendments, but MSRS has not been changed. So it is as it's introduced, as we have before us now. Does anybody else want to be heard on MSRS? Okay, then we will take
Thank
testimony.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very
Mr.
much.
Chairman.
We have a number of people who signed up to testify on PERA. And by the way, we also have another bill on the agenda that deals with PER, police, and fire, which I think we'll deal that as a separate PERA issue. So we'll talk about the PERA general information first, and then talk about police and fire and Senate File 2762. So for the PERA general, I have Grant Thorstad. Mr. Seid has already testified and made his comments. Grace Kelleher, I've got Keith Carlson and Gary Carlson. So they want to come forward?
Mr. Thorstad is a police and fire.
Oh, okay. Mr. Thorstad, if this is – yeah, you're on also on police and fire. So if we're going to talk about the general fund first. So if your remarks are for the police and fire, we'll hear that in just a minute. So.
All right.
Okay, so we'll hear the general fund first. And as I say, and anybody else who wants to testify, please come forward. So what I have for the general fund is Grace Kelleher, Keith Carlson, and Gary Carlson. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Our school employees are based out of two funds, this general PERA fund and the TRA fund. We're here today to support the bill as it's going forward. In very rough early legislative discussions, my board reviewed the status of the plans and felt that the foundations are actually crumbling in these plans and that drastic action needed to be taken to improve that. To that point, I would also like to remind the committee that school districts are a little different than other local governments going forward. We cannot pass these costs on to our taxpayers through a levy. This would be money that we would presently have to take out of the classroom to do this. In the past, the legislators have always been wise enough to give us an offsetting state aid increase when any one of these came forward. But I know today we're in a different situation. Please keep options in mind with how school districts could fund this, especially through a levy that's similar to what the cities and the counties use. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Carlson? I guess, let's see, Gary Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gary Carlson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, an organization that represents 830 of the state's 854 cities. The League's Board of Directors strongly supports the recommendations of the PERA Board and the language that's contained now in the amended versions of Senate File 2631 and House File 2999 for both the PERA General and the PERA Police and Fire Plans. Just a brief background, the League of Minnesota Cities strongly supported the actions that occurred in 2005. We had hoped at that time that those employer and employee contribution increases would have been sufficient to balance the deficits in the plans. That support was strong at that time, but unfortunately now with the recent economic circumstance, we have to go beyond that. I would like to thank Executive Director Mary Vanek for her help in educating our cities across the state. We have been doing our best to try to make sure everyone's well aware of this situation and the need for immediate action, and she and her board have been very voluntary of helping us get that message out to our cities across the state. Two quick side notes, and I'll complete my testimony. Our cities do understand the state is facing very, very severe financial circumstances, and we do expect that we will see additional cuts in the state aids that are shared with cities probably this legislative session. Despite that concern that we also have about the general financial status of the state and our cities, our board continues to strongly support the recommendations of PERA. And then I would like to also note that please keep in mind that many of our active employees, because of the financial stress of the last couple of years, have been seeing 0% increases in their salaries. No steps and lanes, no salary increase at all. We are asking them under this proposal to increase their contribution, in other words, take home less pay in order to help address this problem. And again, our cities are facing similar financial strife, but we think it's time to move forward. Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony with those comments.
Any questions of Mr. Gary Carlson? Well, thank you for spending your birthday with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Keith Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership consists of 13 of the larger counties. I appear in support of Senate File 2631, House File 2999, and also the police and fire bill 2672, and will not repeat testimony on that separately. My main message for you is to do as much as you can, as soon as you can, and by spreading the pain as broadly as you can. I think it's worth emphasizing the document that I've passed out and have shared with most of you on individual visits demonstrates the fact that none of the proposals before you sufficiently takes care of the deficiencies facing any of the statewide plans on a market value basis. At best, we get down to about a remaining deficiency of 2.5%. There's been optimism shared by the directors of these plans that that can be taken care of by further investment growth and the recent constraint on employee salaries. I frankly don't share that optimism. In all likelihood, we will be back here next year having to make further changes. So that, in my opinion, reinforces the need to do as much as you can right now. And the PERA bill 2630 does that by, in part, reducing the COLA by the largest range of any of the proposals before you, from going from 2.5% to 1%. I know that's very difficult for you to do. I know it's very difficult for the retirees to do. But the single-page document that I've passed out shows you that most of the retirees have been receiving increases that put them far ahead of the rate of inflation. If you look at the first row, an individual who retired in 1994 with the cost of living increases that he or she has received since then are receiving a pension that has increased 44%, more than 44%, in excess of the rate of inflation since that time. That is the case for most retirees except for a small group within the early middle part of this decade. I also repeat what you've heard from many others at this time. When we're asking these individuals to just have their increase reduced from 2.5% to 1%, at the same time, Social Security recipients are getting a zero increase this year because inflation simply is not there. As has also been mentioned, our employees not only are facing true zeros on both the COLAs, steps and lanes, many of them are actually facing salary or wage reductions as the result of unpaid time off that they have been required to take in the form of furloughs. So the pain that's being asked the retirees is not too much, particularly in that context, as well as the fact that these employees, as well as our employers and taxpayers, have already stepped up over the past 5 years to pay additional contributions and will be asked for more under this bill. I will also remind you that under current law, PERA has unilateral authority to increase contributions for the general plan on an annual basis with review by this commission. In all likelihood, I think that is going to occur because, again, there still is over a 2.5% deficiency after you enact this. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson, I have one question. This one-page handout you gave us, it doesn't indicate who prepared it. It doesn't indicate the source of information on it. Could you just tell us a little bit about more, you know, where these numbers came from?
Mr. Chairman, members, at our request, Ms. Vanek provided the information for us that in the first column provides the post-fund increase, which applies to all three of the statewide systems, and the comparison to inflation, and then the showing of the aggregate increase in the subsequent columns.
Any questions, Mr. Keith Carlson? Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that it's for all of them. In the past, Mr. Chair, when Ms. Keller, you alluded to in the past, we had levy authority that when an increased contribution came up for the school boards. And I think, Mr. Carlson, when you were in my office, I think it indicated that at sometimes you had levy authority, and that came through a separate tax bill?
I think I can answer. Right now, under the levy limits that apply to cities and counties, we have what's called special levy authority outside the basic limitation to levy for any increase in our pension contributions for these plans. On the other hand, I'll state for Ms. Kelleher, they have no similar authority. They have to manage any increased contributions within their existing revenues from state aids.
So the school boards are the
exception.
Are the exception, then everybody else can do it. And so, Ms. Kelleher, what would it take then to get the school boards to do that?
Ms. Kelleher.
You could include us into this piece of legislation that's already on the books. Our members would appreciate the opportunity to make that decision. It's difficult when you're looking at children in the classroom and how many kids are in a classroom and how many offerings can we provide to make this kind of choice. I mean, if you look at the last year, we've been shifted. Our property tax aids have been shifted. The state is now borrowing 3 months of our aids. We've become sort of like the state's bankers. But unfortunately, when it comes to these kinds of additional costs, there is no way outside of an appropriation from you or a levy authority to recoup these costs.
And Mr. Martin, would that come through? Can that be part of the pension bill, or does that have to go through a tax bill?
Mr. Martin.
Members, you can clearly put a tax provision on the pension bill, but what the consequence would be is that the tax committees would likely want to see the omnibus pension bill.
But that would be a good thing.
Well, depends.
Members, it's part of the process.
I think certainly every step of the way that we can make people more aware of the problems and do a little educating along the way, that's a good thing. In my opinion.
And members, you know, we haven't talked about it. We will later, but, you know, we'll have to figure out, do we want to just roll these, you know, if we decide to adopt these proposals, roll them into the bill that we've been working on since June, or package them up as a separate proposal and start moving them separately, because if there are things that have to go to the tax committee, there's probably no reason to bring everything else we've done to the tax committee. But, you know, but we'll talk about that later on. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Kelleher. As a former school board member, I'm very empathetic to the situation at hand, and I wonder if MSBA has proposed such legislation that would, in fact, give districts that authority.
Ms. Keller?
Mr. Chairman, we've worked on it last year, and we continue to talk about it, but we have not proposed it in a specific bill since we have to wait on the pension bill to know what those costs and levy authorities would be.
Okay. Any other questions on PERA General? Anybody else want to be heard on PERA General? Okay. We have a separate issue, and let's talk about PERA Police and Fire, and there's an item on our agenda that deals with a different proposal for Police and Fire. So I have Grant Thorstad, Dennis Flaherty, Keith Carlson, and Wendy Wolf to talk about police and fire. If they can come forward. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Grant Thorstad.
Go ahead.
Oh, we got his letter.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Grant Thorstad. I'm a former police officer, and by the time I'm eligible for retirement, PERA will have had my money for 28 years. I'm here today regarding Senate File 2631, 2672, and House File 2999 in regard to PERA and the plan to eliminate the deferred annuity augmentation. I'm one of 108 police officers and firefighters who have left employment with PERA, left a PERA-covered position. I, like others, was given a choice to either cash out of my retirement or accept a deferred annuity with no payments until I was at retirement age with a guaranteed 3% increase unto retirement. During the late 1990s and the 2000s, those of us who have had deferred annuities watched PARA provide increases of over 10% to retirees, which went into perpetuity. But those of us who were deferred continue to receive our 3% guaranteed increase. I did not think this was unfair because it was in the agreement I made with PARA. According to PARA, the average deferred member of the Police and Fire Fund is 45 years old and has over 9 years of service as a police officer or firefighter. If these bills are approved, these individuals will lose, on average, 16% of their annual retirement. Considering none of these people ever received more than the guaranteed 3% annual increase during the good years, they should not be asked now to subsidize the high increases that are now the partial cause of PARA's long-term financial liabilities. I first became aware of this in January when I read the PARA website. I was stunned to read PARA had quietly and without notice to deferred members taken the position of proposing to drastically reduce the 3% deferred augmentation. As a deferred member, I do not receive the PARA newsletter, so no notice was given to me other than what I found on the website. I was equally shocked to read PARA would propose such a breach of our agreement, considering the website also states, quote, with assets of over $14 billion for all of our PARA plans, current benefits are not in jeopardy, and that the problems that must be addressed lie in the future, end quote. This indicated to me the fund was not in a crisis situation yet, yet these bills are proposing crisis-type changes to deferred members. Additionally, the proposed bills have languages in them that restore funding levels for retirees in the event funding stability is restored. No such language exists under the deferred annuity computation. This is particularly disturbing in that there seems to be no sense of obligation to honor the commitments made to deferred members, but also no intent to ever restore these benefits back to the promised levels. It would appear the proposal by PARA has not been well thought out and has clearly not been communicated to those impacted by it. As a father of two young children, I made retirement decisions based on the guarantees provided by state law. It's alarming to know that it can be taken away in a sudden and rather secretive proposed change. I think other deferred members would share my concerns if we were made aware of these proposals. I would ask the members of this committee to remove the proposed changes to deferred members in Section 5 and 20 of the various bills and preserve the commitments made to the individuals who made financial decisions to leave their retirement in with PARA based on a guaranteed 3% augmentation.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Thorstad? Thank you. Ms. Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak today. 5 years ago, well, my name is Wendy Wolf. 5 years ago today, my husband was in the intensive care unit at Fairview Southdale Hospital, and the doctors were preparing us for the possibility that he might not survive. He was the commander of the Minneapolis bomb squad, and he was injured by a blast. He's permanently totally disabled, and he has a brain injury. 2 years ago, I testified in front of this committee for an increase in his pension because the loophole in workers' compensation law said that the city didn't have to pay any wage loss to my husband because he receives the disability benefit from PARA. And you approved a change to his pension to put it at 75% instead of the normal 60% for a permanently totally disabled person. Today, because of changes in the contract for the people who are still working and increases that you get for longevity, the pension that my husband receives, and this is just 5 years after he was injured, is the equivalent of 65% of what he would be making if he were still able to work. So we've lost that much just in 5 years. If you include the increased out-of-pocket medical costs that we have to pay because of the way they treat the medical insurance for people who are disabled, we're actually at 59% of what he used to make that we have to live on as a family. I can't work full-time. I have two part-time jobs because my husband needs supervision in his daily living. Because of the loophole in workers' compensation law, Minneapolis saved over $1 million in wage loss payments that they don't have to pay our family. And when we tried to close that loophole over in the Commerce Committee, we had the gentleman from the County Association and the League of Minnesota Cities and the Chamber of Commerce and others, including Council President Barb Johnson, testifying that they couldn't afford to take care of my husband, that it was just too expensive and would set a bad precedent. We have suffered greatly financially as a result of his injury, and I understand the difficulties that the funds are facing and the need to make changes in the benefit increases in order to protect the future of the fund, but I would respectfully request that you consider exempting permanently totally disabled police and fire members from that adjustment because they're already at a disadvantage in the need to take care of their family. The job of being a police officer is more comparable to the military than a normal civilian position, but our state doesn't have the same sorts of support for disabled police officers who are unable to work as they do for veterans who have been disabled in the line of duty. Had my husband been injured as a soldier, and he is a veteran, but he had left the military to become a police officer. Had he been injured in the same manner as a soldier, we would be exempt from paying property taxes on our home. But that exemption doesn't apply to police officers, even though they face the same sorts of dangers. I'm also a veteran, and our oldest son is going to be in Afghanistan next month. So I understand the difference between how veterans are supported and treated by the community and how police officers are supported and treated by the community when they get hurt. So respectfully, I would request that you exempt the approximately 10 people who are in the same situation as our family from making a decrease in their benefits to save the fund. We've already suffered enough. Thank you.
Ms. Wolf, had you called this issue to the attention of PERA before now?
I spoke with Ms. Vanek, and she said that she was concerned because the other groups have many more people who are permanently totally disabled. The general fund has, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 people who are permanently totally disabled, that she was concerned about the fairness issue. But my answer to that would be that the job of a police officer is fundamentally different from the job of the people in the other groups because police officers have no expectation of safety in the workplace. After my husband got blown up, there was no OSHA inspection or safety changes that occurred to protect other people from being hurt. If you get hurt, you're just hurt.
Okay. Thank you. And we might ask Ms. Vanica momentarily to come forward and comment on this or and some of the other issues that are being raised to us. Any questions, Ms. Wolf? Okay, thank you. And Mr. Flaherty, and if there's anybody else on police and fire, this is the time to come forward. Mr. Flaherty? Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dennis Flaherty, Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and I represent about 8,600 full-time police officers throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm going to open up this morning just simply to say that this is something that we have been working on since early fall with representatives of the Professional Firefighters Association and my group and the Minneapolis Police Federation, all of which who took this assignment very seriously because we wanted to from the start get out front of this issue and hopefully and start as soon as possible in an effort to save our fund and to save it for the future. And we are completely in support of the PERA bill that you discussed this morning as it relates to the police and fire fund section of that, because actually those initiatives in there are what came out of this group. They are recommended and they have been brought to the PERA Board of Trustees by our committee. There is just one difference, and that's all I want to talk about this morning, and that difference is how it relates to the retirees and their annual COLA adjustment. And Mary Vanek pointed out, their PERA board's proposal is at 1%. And initially, we're the ones who brought that forward. And we thought that that probably was a logical way to proceed. But then after further discussion, we made a slight departure and instead recommended that retirees, their adjustment be treated by some type of an annual COLA adjustment, whatever the cost of living would be, not to exceed 1.5%. We had a change of heart because we thought 1% was just rather arbitrary, just picking a figure, whether it be 1%, 2%. And we wanted what was in the best interests of the fund, and therefore we potentially could be giving retirees less than the 1%. But yet we also wanted our retirees, should things turn around and the cost of living would rise, then so could their annual adjustment. And thusly, we said, okay, every year, whatever the cost of living is, it will be adjusted in June, and that's what the increase for our retirees will be, not to exceed 1.5%. Brian's going to talk probably to justify a little bit deeper our rationale, but we were trying to balance what's in the best interest of the fund and trying to be as fair as we could to the retirees. And so thusly, that's why our bills are identical to the PARA bill, but for this section relating to annual adjustment for retirees.
And thank you, Mr. Flaherty. And that's Senate File 2672, which is, as I say, substantially like PERA's proposal, except for the cost of living increases.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Now, one question that's going to come up. I'm sure future legislatures are going to deal with cost of living increases at some point. They're going to be changed, adjusted, depending upon how the economy goes. I've seen it certainly in the time on my time in this commission. Don't we get into trouble when we start locking in permanent cost of living increases down the road, Mr. Flaherty? Or Mr. Rice, I guess. Mr. Rice?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Brian Rice, representing the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, which is comprised of 1,600 members of this 11,000 in the PRA Police and Fire Fund and the Police Officers Federation that has over 900 members. To your question, Senator Betzold, I think the yours is a good question about whether locking in cost of living. In the past, the Pension Commission has set benefits in the 80s, visibly or not, tied it to market performance. I think this commission has learned that in hindsight, was not the best choice. On the other hand, back in the 80s, when you look at the formula that is given to public employees, it was much less generous than other states. Teachers' retirement system has presented data to this commission over the last several years that shows their formula, even though it's higher than other public employees in the state, still ranks 33rd out of 33 states in terms of its formula multiplier. The same could be said of the general PRA plan and state plan. This commission has not been overly generous to public employees on a relative measure compared to public employees throughout the country. The formula multiplier is lower. A typical standard in these defined benefit plans is a high 3. Minnesota operates off a high 5. Most plans throughout the country have a 2% multiplier or greater. We're at 1.7. What happened was is the systems made up for it through a more generous post-retirement mechanism. We're now realizing that that's not very sustainable. The question then is what model to use. Do you use the investment-related one? That's a flawed theory. I think a better plan I would submit is something that when a person retires, and Senator Lynch read this off at the very beginning of the meeting, the you need to be attuned to changing economic circumstances. That standard could be interpreted that a better measure is to tie it to some sort of measure of inflation. Because if somebody retires, it's not that you want to get rich. It's that you want to maintain some standard of living. Social Security does that through its cost of living adjustment. And that's one of the reasons we're here today with police and fire. We're not covered by Social Security. It's not a coordinated plan. The pension that law enforcement officers, police and fire get in this state is from the state plan. And so we believe a very strong argument can be made and should be made, unlike the other plans that were presented by TRA, PRA, and MSRS that are largely all coordinated except for a very few of their members that are basic plan members. They're all coordinated with Social Security. They do get an adjustment based on federal law that last year, or at least January of 2009, was 5.8%. January 1 of 2010, it was zero. But there is some inflation-protected component for all other public employees in the state of Minnesota. We think that this plan, PRA Police and Fire, ought to be looked at least in that dimension, that it's since it's not coordinated with Social Security. We also think that our plan is different in this. We've proposed, and PRA boards accepted, going to 10-year vesting. The other plan that PRA has goes to a 5-year vesting plan. The funds and members recognize that there are significant issues that this fund faces, and hence we went beyond what PRA was suggesting and went to 10-year vesting, which does not show up as a cost savings on your report, but we think over time it will translate into reduced total employer costs. Additionally, there are 11,000 members in this plan. We think the state has a very special role with respect to these plans because through the auto insurance premium tax and the homeowners premium tax for police and fire, the state in large funds these plans through a dedicated tax. And to his credit, as Senator Betzel mentioned, Governor Pawlenty throughout his administration has not gone to the pension funding sources as a way to balance the budget. And I think we're fortunate that the governor has not gone there. And so those general fund dollars that have helped undergird certain of the closed plans or these police and fire taxes that are on auto and homeowners have really been a source of local government aid to cities and counties to help pay their retirement costs. And there is as pension costs have gone up modestly, those accounts have largely been able to keep up. So there's many cities and counties that have not had to rely on property taxes to make these contributions to sustain these plans. And it would certainly be our hope in the police and fire community to continue that practice. The proposal, if I could call the commission's attention quickly to page 20 and 21 and 22 of the handout that was the meeting was started off at. The changes that PRA is recommending would save, I know there's been a little bit of a tweak in this with Ms. Vanek, so I don't want to get in too much in the actuarial numbers, but on an actuarial basis, the deficiency is 6.49%. This expected savings from the PRA proposal is about 9.4%. Which results in a sufficiency of 2.9%. Now, the reality is different. The market value numbers that all the funds have been presented to you and the graphs that the fund directors have been presented to you show the market value contribution deficiency as of June 30th of last year. The markets have recovered in earlier testimony in the Pension Commission. Generally, pension plans have been up about 11 to 14% since then, which is good news, which would shrink that deficiency. I think most everyone would say don't assume that the markets are going to recover and this is going to be solved by a market correction. But just so you know, as the picture is being painted, you're getting probably a pessimistic picture on markets, although not entirely. The difference then between our proposal both our proposal and the PRA proposal would solve the current actuarial deficiency. Our proposal would be less. If you go to the graph on page 22, it shows that the actuary has assumed under our proposal of inflation up to 1.5%. I'm pretty sure that the actuary is assuming that it'll be 1.5% every year for the next 30 years. I would submit that there are going to be some of those years in the next 30 years that there won't be 1.5% inflation, and hence our proposal would be less than 1.5%. What the number is, I don't know exactly. I would suspect in this next year it's more likely to be less than 1.5 than it will be closer to 0 than 1.5. And so we are not, I would submit that, fundamentally different than the PRA proposal, and that our cost savings, while not as great as PRA's, would not be as bad as the one that's portrayed on page 22. And lastly, I'd like to end with this. The funds know that we will be back next year. We have no doubt on that. We've sat down with the PRA board and in our group, and we know that we're going to have to come again to make some other changes. And those changes will involve things like looking at some of our basic assumptions. We currently have an early retirement program that allows members to go at age 50. It's subsidized by the other plan members. We've asked PRA to look at the utilization of that, and the police and fire groups have committed to come back together again as soon as the session's over, once the experience study is done, to look at other changes. That maybe have to be on the table to change the early retirement incentive. We may have to look at salary growth or caps possibly. I have a formula that all want to be protected, but we've also made changes a couple years ago on disability. I think the stakeholders want to make sure that these changes are being made to shore up the fund, but we also want to measure twice before we cut. We think the 1.5% makes sense. Now, one other issue I think the commission should be familiar with on all of these is there has been a tweak that MSRS is proposing on salary growth assumption to basically take it from a 4.5% assumption to 4 on both payroll growth and salary growth. That saves, in MSRS's case, about 1% of salary. I would guess it's about the same in PRA by just notching it down 0.5%. They're doing a similar change from 4.5 to 4. Senator Pappas talked about the new normal. I'm not sure we know exactly what the new normal is yet, but it's certainly likely that to assume a 4% salary growth for wages is probably, everybody who works with labor unions in the state would say, where can we get that now? That would be great. It doesn't seem to be there. But you ought to understand that all your pension assumptions are based on this 4% salary growth. And I think that takes some serious reexamination, just like the funds have talked about the 8.5% investment return. How realistic is that? If you change that number down, let's say we said salary growth was 0. You could make that change. We could probably all be much better funded. And you could wave that magic wand and say, well, it's all done. Let's forget about it. I'm not saying you do that. But know that in all of these charts you're looking at as a commission, there are assumptions in here. This has been a serious meeting all day, but if I could divert quickly, I was out deer hunting last fall with two actuaries, Mark Meyer and Pete Cullen. Mark's a really good actuary, and I was kind of half asleep like I'm doing a lot these days, and boom, two guns go off. I wake up and a deer runs by, and Mark Meyer and Pete Cullen are high-fiving each other, and I say, what happened? I said, well, we killed a deer. And I said, no, you didn't. The deer ran. Well, they said, yeah, we did. Pete shot 10 yards in front of the deer, and I shot 10 yards behind the deer, and so we actuarially killed the deer. Well, and I don't mean to make light of the situation, but know that in these documents, you're assuming a 4.5 or 4% salary growth assumption. Now, how realistic is that? You've all sat on finance committees. Senator Betzold has. There hasn't been that kind of growth in anything. At the same time, we're assuming 8.5% investment return. That's high. So I would really urge, I do think that all of these proposals, particularly on the PRA side, are solid ones. We do think in the police and fire case that we ought to be looked at somewhat differently, because you are our only source of pensions. There isn't a Social Security component. And we think that with all due respect to the work that Ms. Vanek and her board did, that the suggestion that we're making to decouple or to get off either an investment-related component or a fixed component, that some kind of measure of inflation is a much better policy choice to make for the commission.
Any questions of Mr. Rice? Mr. Rice, when you're already starting to identify the agenda for next year, I think you're scaring people off of pension.
Mr. Chairman.
Please be careful. Okay, Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I usually ask my dumb questions in private of Mr. Rice and Mr. Kapler, but okay, so a 4% salary growth, then if what the employee pays is a percentage of their salary, then assuming a salary growth then would be a positive thing for the pensions. You sounded like it was a negative thing.
It is, if it's right.
Madam Chair, if you lowered the salary growth?
Yes.
If you lowered the salary growth, you would assume, well, I'll give you a good example. For a long time, we assumed that salaries would grow at 5%. Mm-hmm. Legislative salaries, last time I looked, were about $31,000, and you haven't had a pay raise in 14 years. If you had assumed a 5% salary growth for your legislative pay instead of $31,000 a year, you'd be making $62,000 because that's the effect of inflation. Divide rule of 72, divide the interest rate into the years 5 into 72, 14 years would double your salaries. Now, that hasn't happened with legislators. I don't know that it's happened with a lot of other employees. And every time you ratchet that down, a 4% assumption means the liabilities are less because the liabilities for the legislative pension plan for those that had it in 96 would be double what it is, but it's not because.
So the liability is related to how high the salary is because of the high five.
Absolutely.
That creates the higher liability.
Absolutely. Okay. So, and you're assuming now in all these plans that it's growing at 4.5, and when they ratchet it down, you'll see in these bills that are presented by just making a 0.5% change, you made a 1% change in contributions by lowering it. So that's a very important assumption. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you just do that because you also have to relate it to how much you think you're going to make on investments. I think Mr. Side provided perhaps one of the best testimony when he said 15% of all of the pensions that get paid out here are a result of what the employers contributed because the general rule in pension is 70% of the benefits get paid by investment earnings. And then if it's half employer and half employee, that's how Mr. Side gets the number. 15% of the pension is what a member puts in that is ultimately paid out, and 15% is what the employer puts in. And that's really the key on it. And that's why I'm in total agreement with the pension funds administrators. Do this now. Get a fix now. Because the sooner you fix it, the more sooner the money is going into the plan to earn investments. If you can find ways to trim back benefits that are reasonable and appropriate and tighten up the ship. One of the things that the pension commission was very liberal in the 80s and 90s in reduced vesting. It used to be 20-year vesting for a police and fire fund. Then it was 10. Then it was 5. Then it was 3. Why? Because the money was there. I think it makes some sense to ratchet it up and put it back the other way. If some people have left a plan after a certain period of time and are no longer following a career as a police and fire fund, it doesn't make a lot of sense to be putting a pension out there for them. That we did a lot on disability. Senator Betzel and Representative Murphy carried a bill that PRA, police and fire found there were some issues with disability and they needed to be tightened up. Now, it maybe went a little bit too far, and graciously Senator Betzel and Representative Murphy corrected that situation for a few people who were injured between age 50 and 55. But generally, we haven't seen all of the effect of that yet roll into the plan to see how much of that's tightened up on the police and fire plan. That's another reason why the membership here is a little bit more reluctant to go as far as the PRA board would do, because you have to look at a lot of these internal tightening up. I guess I'd compare it to you're doing an energy audit on your house, and how much are you saving by fixing a leak in a window or under a door? It might be a lot more than you think. You can't cost it necessarily. You're only going to see it over time with experience to see how things change. And on this, you know, this salary, I think that the fund directors are responsible in coming forward with what they're doing. You shouldn't use an actuarial fix. But as you look at all of these things, I think the commission should ask some pretty hard questions of them to say what exactly are the assumptions that we're operating on and how much could we save. And I think you want to be careful in the salary growth assumption. We don't have inflation now, but we have a massive debt in this country. $1 trillion federal, or the short-term deficit is $1.6 trillion. The national debt's, you know, $12, $13 trillion, all these other things. Historically, the only way you get out of this debt is either you have a major conflagration in World War or you have huge inflation,
which in effect devalues the currency, which wipes out the debt. And that's a scary prospect, too, for retirees.
Okay. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on PERA, police, and fire? Ms. Vanek, did you want to come back? Because we have some issues that were raised on the permanent total disability for police and fire, as well as this cost of living proposal. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA director. Quite honestly, I'm not sure where I'm supposed to start. But one thing I would like to clarify, the police and fire fund is not subject to the actuarial assumption changes that are being recommended in the bigger bill. An experience analysis has not yet been done on that plan. There is one scheduled to be undertaken this spring. And that's part of what Mr. Rice was talking about, is that we really do want to look carefully at the experience within the police and fire plan and determine if there are areas there that need modification that could generate savings. One of the things that I do need to clarify is the fact that when you lower your assumed percentage growth on your total payroll, that means that takes into consideration your entire membership and the salaries. When you lower the assumed increase in that total payroll and you have an unfunded liability, it increases the amount of money you need to collect to pay off the unfunded liability because you're dividing it across a lower base of salary. So while assuming lower salaries going forward or a lower growth in salaries by individuals going forward will limit your growth in liabilities because you're not calculating a high five on a higher number, it also has a counter effect on the total payroll because when you have an unfunded, you have to collect a percentage of pay to pay that off. And when you're collecting it on a lower amount of money, it's a higher contribution. So it's something that we will bring forward to you when we have the experience analysis completed on the police and fire fund. With respect to Ms. Wolf's request, actually her husband is the only individual currently receiving a total and permanent disability benefit out of the police and fire fund, and that was based on that special legislation. When that bill was advancing, we were asked how many other individuals already receiving duty disability benefits in police and fire may have qualified if this benefit were in place. And that's when we estimated 10 or 11 other individuals. No one else thus far has been granted that. And the formula was specifically set at 75% for that case. That is not the current formula in our plan. It's still 60%. My concern, as I shared with Ms. Wolf, is that as soon as you start carving out an exception for individuals, then others will come forward. And I understand what she articulated, but I am concerned about carving out an exception to the retiree adjustment for one individual or even a handful. Our general plan does have 2,100 total and permanent disability benefit recipients, and they're certainly not law enforcement or public safety. But again, it's a total and permanent test, so I'll leave you with that. With respect to the police and fire membership's proposal on inflation up to 1.5%, the board, when asked to support it, chose to remain at the 1% for all plans, primarily because we had so much discussion about different iterations of what should that be, that they wanted me to carry forward the bill at 1%. I don't know if you're planning on a vote today, Mr. Chair, but I would be happy to entertain additional discussions with the group over the next week. But right now, the board's position was they really wanted to stay at the 1% because of limiting the growth in the liabilities to get that plan back in shape, as well as our other plans.
Well, obviously, I'd like to try to wrap up these three fund bills if I can today, but we're not done for the year yet. I mean, we're going to meet next week, and so there's going to be some cleanup and so forth. So if there's still issues hanging out there, we'll be meeting next Friday, and people can come on back in with adjustments, tweaking, and so forth, but I'm not looking for new issues to take in here, folks. So, Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would then ask the commission to consider if they wanted to do something different for our police and fire members at the request of that group, contrary to what we're proposing for our other plans. The general plan, we're really concerned about raising it up because of the funded level of that plan. But we understand also that we're at a much lower level than the other two groups are. The other two statewide plans are coming in.
Any questions, Ms. Vanek? Sarah Lynch?
Mr. Chair, I have a question of staff. Is there any precedent when benefit adjustments have been made, as we're talking about today? Is there precedent to carve out certain exceptions, as has been discussed here or proposed informally today?
Mr. Martin?
Members, the adjustments that you're talking about right now are diminishments of benefits, and that does not occur very often. Is that the context that you're raising your question? Or?
Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, I was thinking more specifically of the, particularly the comments of Ms. Wolf earlier and the comments of Ms. Vanek. And so when adjustments like this are discussed and ultimately made, have we in the past picked particular constituencies that were within that larger group but were carved out or exempted?
Mr. Martin.
Senator, I believe that it's post-retirement increases that you're talking about. Before 1969, when there were post-retirement increases, they were not granted automatically, and they were ad hoc, and they tended to be across the board increases. In 69, when the predecessor to the post-retirement fund was created, there were different increase rates for 1 or 2 years based on different mortality assumptions, because mortality gains were included in the formula, not just investment gains. And when mortality gains were taken out of the formula after that point in 71, there were no longer any differences. They were across the board for all plans. And the proposal for the dissolution of the post-retirement fund replaced it with a flat 2.5% increase for all funds across the board.
Okay, Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The one issue that I don't know if was addressed was the deferred annuity piece. Is that, and maybe, I don't know, that's for Ms. Vanek or staff. Is that in the context of a contract, you know, where if someone retires and they're, where they enter into a contract, like an annuity, where they think they're going to be getting this certain percentage going forward, or is it something that's subject to change?
Yeah, that was Mr. Thorstad's issue, yeah. Ms. Vanek?
Either way.
Members, the court doesn't actually view these things as contracts. They view them as if they were contracts. It's a promissory estoppel doctrine, so it's not purely a contract. So there is no actual formal entering into any contract. It is part of the benefit plans of each of the plans that we're talking about here. The augmentation is not something that's subject to board discretion or some other enterprise. It's set forth in statute. The post-retirement adjustment rate has been reduced once before for members who were already deferred. 1978, I believe, was the, or 1980, it was changed. And without any extensive notice and affecting our deferred members at that time. So there is some precedent. No one litigated the issue at that point. So arguably it's part of the contract to the extent that any benefit that's provided for in statute is part of the contract. But there is at least one element or one item of precedent for reducing it. Okay. We've reduced it for new hires also in 2006, for instance.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Vanek, I guess your answer to the question about whether you support the police and firefighters going to the up to 1.5%, I guess I want some clarity there. I didn't understand. Would the para board support their proposal or not support their proposal, or are you neutral on it?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the direction I got from the board is that because we had already taken a position at 1%, and we feel very confidently that it's a necessary step. When the police and fire membership again approached the board on whether or not they'd support inflation up to 1.5% for their group, the board was not inclined to support it separate, but they basically remained neutral to give the pension commission some discretion if they felt that because they were not a Social Security covered group and you thought that that was more appropriate, we could work through that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Governor Murphy.
The other groups, Ms. Vanek, are coordinated with Social Security.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
So the police and fire are the only group that isn't, and so that would be the difference.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to publicly acknowledge Mr. Thorstedt's concern. We did have a deferred member benefit, a deferred member newsletter in production, but we pulled it back because of the differences of the different percentages that were being discussed. And we posted on the website what the board had decided in December. They have since changed that, brought it down to zero, and we do have a deferred member newsletter in process, but we do understand that isn't in advance of the bill being proposed. So in terms of notification, we would certainly be notifying them, but probably not quickly enough for most of them to be, based on his concern. However, I'm a bit frustrated with myself. I had a memo from the commission's actuary from the late 70s that talked about that there shouldn't be deferred augmentation, that the fact that it was created because of people who moved from, like, para to state retirement system to teacher's retirement system, and then when the combined service annuity laws were passed in 1975, that there really wasn't a need for deferred augmentation anymore. I couldn't find that memo. So I'm sure staff has it because it was by the commission's actuary. But that was kind of part of the discussion with our board, is it's a unique feature, and when we could afford it, it was great. But because the plans are now less well-funded, it is, again, one of those places we're asking all stakeholders to contribute to the solution.
Okay. After we hear from TRA, then we'll certainly entertain any motions, amendments, whatever, to the plans that we've heard. So anything else on PERA? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Keith Carlson from Minnesota Intercounty Association. I just want to speak to the deferred augmentation provision right now and make sure that the commission members understand what that currently is, because it was somewhat misstated, and understand how that compares to what is the state of the affairs for most employees in the private sector. The current deferred augmentation is a guaranteed 3% increase in your pension benefit until you reach age 55, and it's 5% from age 55 until such time as you retired. As somebody who spent the majority of his career in a defined contribution type plan and left that in 1999, I would love that rate of return, because basically the money that I had in 1999 is exactly where I'm at in 2009, having seen no investment return whatsoever from the market. And that's the way it is for the private sector. For most people in what's now the norm, 401k, defined contribution, you have a choice when you leave employment. You can either leave the money with what is soon to be your past employer and depend on the investment return that you may get, or you could roll it over into an IRA. You are not guaranteed a 3%. You're not guaranteed a 5%. Again, I will remind you that none of the proposals that have been put before you completely deal with the deficiency. For the PERA, police and fire, after doing everything that has been proposed in this legislation, there is still a 6.23% deficiency that remains. So any item that you pull out of that bill increases the remaining deficiency that is certain to need to be addressed in future years. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions?
Sir, Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, so can staff just explain to me this in comparison to what Mr. Carlson was just saying here? When someone makes the decision to leave early, what is their choices? Do they have the choice to pull out their money from the pension and roll it over into an IRA, or is that money left there?
Members, for most public employees in a defined benefit plan, they have the choice of a deferred benefit when they leave if they're not at our retirement age, or a refund of their member contributions only. Mr. Carlson is referencing the unclassified employees plan, which is a somewhat unique defined contribution plan applicable to legislative and other employees.
Right. So you wouldn't, Mr. Chair, so you wouldn't be able to get the growth if you worked there for 10 years, if you worked for the state for 10 years, you wouldn't pull out the growth that would have happened, arguably, to the money you've contributed over those 10 years?
Representative, no. The investment earnings on your actual account don't matter. I mean, they're not even calculated in most of our retirement plans. It's the overall funds investment growth that's kept track of. But a member receives currently a 6% interest on their member contributions only if they were to take a refund. Otherwise, the deferred benefit is the other option. And for someone with 10 years of service, it's likely to be the more valuable of the two.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on this topic? Okay. Representative Nielsen.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair.
Jeez.
Just a motor jet.
A gender's been changed today. I've been
anyway.
House of Representatives.
Mr. Chair.
It's your voice.
Adam Speaker. Your voice.
I guess the question
that Jim Metzen voice.
If the employee were to have taken that money out, that his contribution, what happens to the employer's contribution? That does that stay in the fund and then becomes a benefit when he retires, or does it stay in the fund and he loses that?
Members. Representative Nelson, when a member leaves and takes a refund, they cancel all their service credit in that pension plan. They have no benefit other than the refund plus interest. The employer contributions, which have just become part of the plan, are what's known as turnover gain. Mm-hmm. It's an actuarial gain. It reduces other liabilities. And the member, unless they return to public service, repay that refund plus interest and reinstate that service credit, have no further access to that value.
Any other questions? Okay, let's hear from the TRA. People have an interest in that, and then we'll circle back again to look at the proposals before us. I have here a number of people want to testify in TRA. Charles Hiley, Charlie Kite, Russ Stanton, Walt Munsterman, Rose Hermanson, Roger Aronson, Grace Kelleher, and Jan Allswager, and also members. I was asked to put on the agenda Senate File 506 and House File 492. That is an issue that you're quite familiar with. We looked at it last year, which would have been a benefit increase for teachers. We had considerable discussion on it last year, but so I don't know that we need to get all the details again. If we'll have a refresher on it, but that was a proposal we actually looked at last year. So, welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Go ahead. Senator Bessel, it's all right if I start.
Go ahead.
I think I'm second on the list. But I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, represent the school superintendents across the state. And I will pledge to that I will testify much shorter than my colleague Brian Rice did. So.
That's not hard.
That's one positive thing. First of all, let us begin by we support the recommendation of the Teachers Retirement Fund for stabilizing the pension. We like the fact that all of the stakeholders are participating in this. The retirees are taking a limitation on what they're going, their growth of their retirements are going to be. The employees are contributing, and the employers are contributing. We think that's a fair way to approach this. We also recommend that this be done now. There is a tremendous power in starting to increase these contributions now so that we can bring this fund back more quickly than if we delay and let the problem go on. There's power in the growth of money. We also think that if we don't do this now, there's a significant risk. And I'll just point out two groups that have a significant risk. Earlier, somebody mentioned a little bit about the disconcerting effect this has on retirees. But I also say that it also has a very disconcerting fact on our younger workforce. We've got thousands of young teachers that are contributing into the pension fund now. And if they have a sense that that pension fund is not going to be stable long term, that creates a real disincentive for them to stay in the profession. And we want them to stay in the profession with us. There is one large outstanding issue for TRA, and that's the fact that the post-1989 employees have a very different set of rules. And I know there's always been talk about when do we get this fixed. It is the opinion of our association that we need to stabilize the fund first, get that done, get back on the road to financial health, and then come back and tackle that second problem. So we see this as a 1-2 type of an effort. So with that, we think it's the prudent, responsible decision that was made by the Teachers Retirement Fund, which, by the way, the trustees of which are, the majority of them are teachers who have agonized about this because they know they're representing their active members and their retired members. And I think that they've done a good job of putting this together, and we support it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kite. Any questions, Mr. Kite? Okay, next.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Charles Helley, and I'm president of REAM, Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. And we have about 9,000 retired educators in REAM. Our membership includes retired teachers, administrators, and school support staff. We have membership in every legislative district here in Minnesota. REAM supports SF2499-HF2953. We believe the TRA fund needs financial sustainability after the financial losses suffered by the fund in the market downturn in 2008-2009. And we do want to see pensions continue to be paid out after 2032, even though most of our present membership may not be around by 2032. We believe in the shared plan of freezing retiree payments for 2 years and the increase for the employee and employer over 4 years. Many of our members know they paid 6.5% of salary as active educators and that the state paid 8.1% of salary. We do not believe this is equally shared paying that is being proposed, however. When the TRA fund reached 100% of funding, the legislation in place at that time lowered payments by employee and employer to 5% each of salary. Nothing was put in place in case the fund dipped below 100% of funding. Perhaps no one thought the funding level would ever drop below 100% because our economy would always be strong and the TRA investments would always be great. We are also aware that the state average contribution nationally to state educator pensions funds is 8.5%, and Minnesota is presently at 5.5%. REAM does believe action is needed by the Minnesota legislature now, as the cost of stabilizing the TRA fund will be even greater if it's delayed into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Helley? Okay, next. Mr. Stanton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which represents about 3,800 full and part-time faculty at the seven state universities. The Interfaculty Organization supports House File 2953, Senate File 2499, or at least the most important aspects of those bills. First of all, we support raising both the employer and the employee contributions by 2% phased in over 4 years. It's not going to be easy for our members. They are one of the unions that took a 0% and 0% pay increase this biennium. And given the huge budget shortfalls for the next biennium, we'll probably be looking at flat salaries for another 2 years. However, we support this increase because TRA is financially in very bad shape. TRA has an unfunded liability based on asset values of $9.2 billion, or 5.1 if you use the five-year smoothing method. Even if you use the $5.1 billion figure, that's still a shockingly large unfunded liability. It would take a combined employer-employee contribution of 16.57% of pay from now until 2037 to get the fund back to full funding. And we strongly urge you to resist the temptation to believe that a recovery in the stock market is going to get you out of this problem. The stock market was only one of the causes of this problem. Much of the problem was created by a flawed post-retirement cost of living adjustment back in the 1990s that gave out cost of living adjustments of 8, 9, 10, 11% a year at a time when the real cost of living was only 2%. And that, coupled with a drop in contribution rates during the good times, were major contributors to this problem. There's not much you can do about those problems now. I mean, that water is over the dam. It's future generations that are going to pay for this. But don't expect that the stock market alone, even if we have a rally, is going to solve this problem. Even if you don't address these problems, even if you use what I consider a pretty optimistic assumption of 8.5% returns on investment for the next 22 years, TRA will run out of money at 2032. The longer you postpone addressing this problem, the higher the contributions have to be to solve it. And frankly, if you let it go too much longer, politically you're not going to have the ability to raise the contributions enough to solve the problem. And so it needs to be addressed now. The IFO also supports suspending the annual cost of living for TRA retirees for 2 years as proposed in the bill. In each of the last 2 years, TRA retirees got a 2.5% cost of living adjustment. I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics CPI calculator. In 2008, the real cost of living, the CPI, was negative 0.34%. And in 2009, it was 1%. So even if you suspended it for 2 years, it basically would bring retirees' benefits pretty much in line with what inflation has been. In addition, it provides a mechanism whereby some of those who received some very generous cost of living adjustments during the 1990s can help solve some of this problem rather than put it all on future employees, future teachers, or current active teachers. Finally, the IFO opposes any more benefit increases to TRA until the fund is in better shape financially. We shouldn't be driving the fund further in the hole by offering benefits that you cannot pay for. The post-89 teachers do have some very valid concerns. Their benefits are not as good as the pre-89. And I think they should be first in line if the funds ever get back to good financial shape. But right now we can't afford those benefits, and frankly, we think it would be financially irresponsible to offer them. So those are our views. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Any questions of Mr. Stanton? Okay, go ahead. Ms. Hermanson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. It's been like a history lesson that I've lived through because I've been following pensions for over 31 years now, and all of these different nuances have surfaced at some time or other during that time. I'm representing a committee of 13. You've received a letter from us and this was passed by our committee, our board, and we are here to support Senate File 2499, House File 2953. The TRA has been very gracious in sharing with us information all along the line. We see part of our role is to educate our members about this because this is going to be a difficult time for all of them, the actives, retirees, and we represent roughly 7,000 active and retiring members of TRA. It's very important that we communicate with them because there are going to be changes that hurt all of them. In December, they adopted these principles before we knew the details of the bill, and I'd like to leave you with basically 3 points. One, we really would encourage action now. I think you've heard enough testimony that if we don't act now, we just have a bigger problem down the road. Number two, it is a shared sacrifice. It's a fair shared sacrifice. It impacts retirees with the freeze and with the reduction in COLA until we're back to a sustainable level. It impacts actives, and it also impacts the employers. We'd like to have some state contribution, but we're realistic to know that's not a reality right now. We would encourage you to maintain the integrity of the benefits in the long term for both the actives and the retirees, which this bill attempts to do. And I'd leave you with one, our seventh principle. The kids are impacted by this in the state. We really would encourage you to look at some option to allow the school districts to recapture some of their contribution because that impacts the classroom and impacts class sizes and impacts the program for kids. So I know that's not the purview of this committee necessarily, but we would encourage you to look at that option. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Ernst. Any questions? Okay, Mr. Ernst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Roger Ernst, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary School Principal Associations. And we're here in support of Senate File 2499 and 2953. Not that this testimony can add anything to the information base that the committee has or the arguments that you know the arguments very well, pro and con. But we do think it's important to come forward and say that we do support this bill. I think it's important for the pension commission to know that TRA has worked very hard coming out to our organizations, meeting with both of our boards, going through the details of what the issues are that are surrounding the fund, what its needs are, they have stressed with us, and our members have given their endorsement to this as well, the timeliness part of this and the urgency that this needs to be done now. This is not a particularly pleasant discussion for policymaker side. It certainly isn't easy for folks that are looking at paying additional benefits and how do we do that within the confines of our school budgets. But we do support this bill, and frankly, we're thankful for their efforts of the information that they provided to us and the ability to come here and talk to you today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Harrison? Okay, Mr. Munsterman.
Chairperson Betzel, members of the committee, I'm Walt Munsterman. I'm the president of Education Minnesota, retired. It's a merged organization between the Minnesota Federation of Teachers and the old MEA. I come before you today and with some reservations, not on the fixing of the plan, but on the equity factor within this structure. Our members Luther Thompson and Lori Hacking have spent many hours visiting with our members and walking us through, and they've done an excellent job with this. Their major concern is that we're giving up to 2.5%, and the fear is this. The easiest thing for the legislature to do is, because we don't have it, it's easy not to give it to us. And the fear is that the other parties may not be treated that same way. So that's the biggest fear. They need an assurance that they will be treated equally through this complete process. As they have their discussion, they talk about they pay property taxes. Their expenses go up. Prescription drugs, whether we like it or not, as we get older, that becomes a big issue for retired people. And they understand that. Mr. Side took a large part of what I wanted to talk about today, and that was the impact of retirees on the state of Minnesota and its economy. I think that's something we need to look at very carefully because every dollar that is not put into the retirement system is a dollar that does not generate something through our economy. I would hope that as you go through and continue this process, that you do watch very carefully the equity within the structure. We understand it needs to be fixed. We understand that, the school districts need a way to fund this. Retirees in this state, not just teachers, but have given themselves to the citizens of the state of Minnesota in the work that they've done. And the greatest resource we have in this state is the education of our children. And for those of us that have given our lives and our times to that process, I think you need to keep that in mind, that we need it to be treated fairly. I know you have a hard task before you. I know that our organization will be around to support you as we walk through the other committees with this bill. Are there any questions?
Let me just comment. As you know, Mr. Munsterman, I wish we could make promises and assurance what's going to happen in the future, but one legislature cannot bind a future legislature. So if they want to change the cost of living or do something in the future, a future legislature can do that. You know, and even if we lock something right now that all your members like, that can change. And that's how the process works sometimes. So anything else? Okay. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to reiterate what I shared with you on PERA. My membership supports this and really feels that this basement is starting to crumble with this pension fund looking at going bankrupt in 2032. We feel this is a key issue that needs your attention now. School districts presently do not have a system to cover the increased employer cost this would be. We would be hopeful there would be a levy or state aid, as there has been in past years, to cover this, and we will be pursuing that. But we also feel equally strongly that a benefit increase cannot be part of it at this time. Our members would find it unacceptable when we are looking at general education aid cuts presently in House and Senate bills that cut us as far as $450 a child. This is going to be extremely difficult for us to find the next few years, and it's important to us that we really fix the foundation before we put any additional wings on the house. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Keller. Thank you. And the last person I have testifying on behalf of TRA issues is Jan Olswanger. Welcome to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, my name is Jan Olswanger with Education Minnesota, and I appreciate many of the comments that have been made here today, and we would support and agree with many of those comments. I know that there are a couple of bills here on the agenda today that are of interest to Education Minnesota, and I know that you are short of time. So I think it might be wise, if it's okay with the chair, to roll my testimony all together and limit it to the second part, to the second bill, and then I think you could take that off the agenda.
Okay, go ahead.
A couple of years ago, you'll recall that there was a bill and the legislation passed, signed into law, that would merge the post fund with the active fund. And at that time, we told legislators that we would be opposed to that bill, and that we, if it did pass, that we would be opposed to any kind of active member contribution increase, because this was a debt in the post fund. As you will recall, you were very loud and very clear, very vocal about this. And so today, as predicted, I am here to oppose a contribution increase from our actives. I want to give you a historical perspective, and I appreciate the comments that the retirees made and some of the other testifiers, because they understand the problem as well. While the financial stability is incredibly important to Education Minnesota, and while we have heard that this bill is a shared sacrifice, I want to put it into perspective for you. I want you to think, if you were one of the active members who does not have the rule of 90, and what has happened to them. I have two documents that are going to be passed out or have been passed out.
Yeah, we got them.
Have been passed out? Okay. And I'd like to share with you some of the information on the document. And this, the first one that is the graph with the green bars and the horizontal graph is from the Teacher Retirement Association. If you go back to the TRA contributions in the past, you will see that the employer contribution at one point was approximately 8.5%. And when the market was doing well and the fund was sufficient, the state made the decision, along with all of the other groups, to reduce the employer contribution. At that point, both the employer and the employee were paying 5.0%. You may also look at another document that has the historical contribution rates on the table format. And you'll see in 1997 that the rate of contribution the contribution for the employer was 8.14%. And the ratio of the funding was at 101.3%. And so it was reduced. If you look historically over since 1980, when there was a problem with the fund, the employer, and at some times the employee increased their contribution rates and that they reduced them when they were sufficient. I want you to think about a 401k or a 403b. If you have money and you're contributing as an employee and the employer, would you say to yourself or the employer, the employee say, okay, well, the fund is doing really, really well, so we're not going to contribute anymore for a while? That is like taking money in some ways out of your fund because you're not putting the future contributions in. The reason you don't do that is because you want to make sure that you keep the fund growing so that in the bad times you have maybe an average or that you're doing well over the long term. But what we did in 1997 is the employer contributions were reduced, and that's like reducing contributions to a 401k or 403b. You don't do that, generally. And the historical figures show that in the bad times, people have stepped up to the plate. The state has stepped up to the plate. Take a look then on the right of that document, and you'll look at the employee and the employer contributions. In Minnesota, you can compare the teachers' fund with 34 states because we're coordinated with Social Security. And the 34 states, the average for the employee across the country is 5%. Minnesota is 5.5%. We're above average. Not much. But take a look at the employer contribution. In Minnesota, the employer contribution is 5.5%, while across the country it is 8.6%. Then when you start adding in, and I do have a document that I can distribute to you later. I don't believe you have this document at present. I do have the document, and I will get it to you today. But you have seen this before. It compares Minnesota teacher pension plans with other pension plans around the country. You want to be, if you have a good pension plan, at the very top of all of these. Well, Minnesota, you don't see any gray area here because Minnesota is near the bottom of every one of these categories, except for one. And the one that we are better at is kind of a flip in terms of the rating. We are above average, like I said earlier, on the employee. That's not good for teachers in terms of looking at costs and benefits. So when you look at all of these factors that I've just pointed out, it kind of adds up to not really feeling to the active members like a shared sacrifice. Because in the TRA proposal, where the actives would pay 2% increase over 2 years, and please note that PERA and MSRS are not asking for those types of contribution increases from their members. It's easier for them to get up here and say that they're supporting it because they're not in the same situation. In addition, Ms. Hacking said that our demographics are different. Yes, they are. Our teachers, when they get into the profession, they tend to stay, or else they leave right away. That means a different burden on the fund, and it means that they're affected differently. And so you have to look at that as well. So if I were to summarize this piece, why are actives opposed to this? Number one, when the pension fund, the post fund was merged, they took on the debt of the post fund. In the past, when there have been contribution decreases by the employer, they agreed to it, and they anticipated that when there was a deficiency in the fund, the state would be there. It doesn't appear that they're not, that they're going to be here. They have been paying, the actives, there's 70% at least that do not have the rule of 90, have been paying for, actuarially, have been paying for the benefit for those who had the rule of 90. They are paying more than the average teacher across the country. The employer is paying less than the average employer across the country. So it doesn't feel like a shared sacrifice. And, Mr. Chair, in terms of the second bill, I think this stands for itself as a documentation. Last year, Education Minnesota came to the legislature with TRA in a win-win solution where we were paying 100% of a pension benefit equity, all the contributions that were necessary paid for it, and a little bit of the deficiency. And when we talk about starting paying earlier rather than later to fix the fund, Representative Thiessen and Senator Betzold had the right idea to try to get in early and fix it, and it didn't happen. We are not here to say that we shouldn't have a stable fund. That is one of our legislative priorities. But putting a 2% increase on our active members to pay for the debt that they do not feel that they entirely created. Some of it, yes, the market has turned south, and there is some responsibility there. But we ask you to think long and hard, be very thoughtful about what you do to the active members who have been, we feel, paying more than their share for a lesser benefit to other teachers and to other teachers in Minnesota and other teachers around the country. You have a very difficult problem to solve, and we will be there to try to help you fix it so that it is a win-win solution for everyone.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Olsweiger. Last year, of course, I think the members will remember that your proposal, which was Senate File 506 and House File 592, would have increased the teacher contribution rates, but tied to a benefit increase, as you've indicated, and would have done things like, for instance, instead of working until age 66, have some individuals who could retire at age 62, and there was a number of factors in there. It was a difficult sell last year, as you may recall. I think coming into this year's session, I think any proposal to increase any benefits would be very difficult, for the legislature, to consider. I think just the climate around here is just not in a mood for that. And as I understand TRA's position, they're saying they need every cent they can get, and that's why they're saying they've got to get the employee contribution increases. I mean, that's their position. I understand, obviously what you've laid out before us, and these are not easy on any of us. So any questions, Ms. Olsweiger? Representative Thiessen.
Well, just a comment on that, because I think the point that a lot of people made as they came up here is we do need to fix this post-89 situation, and we need to do it in the future. But we've been saying that for a long time, and I think the point that Education Minnesota made when we did the post-fund closure and when we didn't pass something last year and again this year is maybe we should just stop saying we're going to fix it, because the longer we wait, the more money it's going to take. So, I mean, I think maybe the point we should be making is that that's just going to be what benefits are going to be, because if we wait till 2015, we have 4 years to fix the problem. It's going to be hugely expensive, and maybe we shouldn't string people along and just say we just don't have the funds to do it.
Well, you know, it's not just in pensions or PMTs. In a lot of areas, we pass bills around here, and we pat ourselves on the back that we solved some great problem, and sometimes we find out, you know, maybe it really didn't matter, you know. So, but we don't know. You don't know until down the road how it's going to play out. So any other questions of Mrs. Elsweiger? Thank you. Okay. Anybody else want to be heard? Please come forward. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, Lee Warren, Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Last night, our board of directors met, and our board is made up of three equal components, school board members, teachers, and administrators. And we talked about this 2499, its companion House bill. No one was too excited about increasing their contributions, yet everyone felt it was the only thing to do. And MREA would support 2499 in the interest of your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please come forward, and if there's anybody else who wanted to be heard today, please come forward now because we're ready to start wrapping it up. Come forward. Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Douglas Stein. I'm a retired educator, and I belong to REAM, but I'm not speaking on behalf of REAM. My concern with this bill so far is in the post-retirement adjustment area that going back when I first retired, we got an investment benefit, if there was one, which in those days started off pretty well. And we were also getting a COLA. Now, a couple of years ago in the legislature, they removed the COLA. Now, I hear COLA being used here. And if I'm not mistaken, there's a difference between just the regular adjustment and the cost of living, which is based on the CPI. And my concern here is that really the adjustment, well, as an example of that, last year the pensions got 2.5%, and this year we got a 2.5% increase. Now, this was not a CPI benefit. This was a benefit that was thrown out by the legislature. And so we lost another 2.5% of that money that could have been still in the pension funds. And even now with the adjustments that are being made, there's still money going out that is going to be reducing the pension plans rather than staying neutral as far as that money is concerned. It's still going to go down, based on this, down to 1%. And then it's going to go back if we ever get up to 90%. Now, my suggestion, it would make more sense to have a CPI pension adjustment called a COLA. We wouldn't have got that 2.5% if the COLA was still there, because inflation was nothing last year.
1.5% was
quick. There would have been more money saved. So that would be my suggestion, like it's going to travel. But putting back the CPI adjustment makes much more sense than continuing with these sporadic adjustments that the legislature have made, which a lot of retirees certainly enjoyed, but this is what's caused the problem. Just as the investment side of things caused them problems, having those big adjustments back in the late 90s. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Any questions? Is there anybody else who's here who wanted to be heard on the issues? Oh, so Representative Murphy.
Mr. Stein, where are you from?
Pardon me?
Where are you from?
I'm from Anoka County.
Okay. And you might want to talk to Mr. Kapler or someone from the St. Paul teachers. They have a pilot project going and see how they're doing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, again, anybody else who wanted to be heard today? Well, members, I guess we can start discussing the proposals we have before us. Last week we sent the MRF bill out separately because it had an appropriation. as I look to the coming week of the legislature with the budget forecast and coming out, if we tried moving a bill out this week, I don't think anything's going to happen. So we might as well vote on what we can today on the three funds and just leave it here. If there's changes or reconsideration or whatever you want to do next week, you know, we'll have that opportunity. I'm thinking, you know, my thought here, and I'm interested to see what the members' thoughts are, is that we probably ought to roll the TRA, PERA, and MSRS proposal into one of the three bills, probably Senate File 2573, House File 2952, which is the MSRS bill. I'll just put all three in there. That's just my proposal. These are separate and unique issues, and I'm just thinking that maybe traveling separately would be better than tying it up with a lot of the mundane stuff that we've been working on since last June. So, but that's just my thought. So what's the pleasure of the commission? And if Senator Pappas and Senator Rosen are – Senator Rosen's back. Senator Pappas is in with an earshot. Now would be a nice time to return. Senator Olson had to return to her district for a matter, so – What do you wish to do, members? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, tell me a little more about your thought about the separation from the omnibus bill.
Well, last week we rolled the MRF bill into the omnibus bill, and we sent it out separately. And in fact, in the Senate, it's going to be heard in a policy committee on Monday. I'm still trying.
Wednesday.
And we're trying to get the bill to the finance folks so they can start looking at that appropriation. What appropriation issues do we have in these bills? Do they need to be? I mean, we heard some discussion about tax issues, but Mr. Martin, do we have appropriations in here that we need to be concerned with?
Members, in some sense, no, and in some sense, yes. You have no, you do not have an appropriation of money. You do have a state agency impact. The MSRS proposal would increase, would add an employer additional contribution to the state patrol plan that does not currently exist. That set at 10% of pay would also increase the regular employer contribution of the state patrol plan, which affects primarily the public service public safety department by 1.2% for a total of 11.2% increase in contributions, providing no additional state appropriations for that purpose. So there's no impact from a pure appropriation standpoint, but there is a state agency budget impact.
We heard, what, $7 million for the patrol?
$7.5 million.
So there are fiscal considerations, I think, for these issues that, my thinking is it might be better just to, you know, send these three bills plus. As I say, we're going to hear Duluth and St. Paul next week, and you know, is it better just to kind of roll all these funds, you know, the reforms into one bill? I'm open. I'm just kind of throwing it out to see what you wish to do. So, and the bigger question is, are we ready to vote on the three big bills that we've heard today? So,
well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas,
I guess I'm concerned about the TRA proposal if Ed Minnesota opposes it. That will we be able to, we might have difficulty passing it. And it could bring down the other bills then. So that, I'm thinking maybe that we need to separate the bills out. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would rather, I don't know how this is going to ultimately go, but this, what we've heard today is going to be, you know, more tough sledding than anything we've worked on this past year. We're talking about school districts having to find money within their budgets to pay for the increases. We're talking about employees who have not had cost of living increases, you know, having to dig within their own paycheck to pay for this. None of these are going to be easy. And these bills that we've heard today are probably going to take more attention than everything else we've done. So, Senator Lynch.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to give these three proposals a little bit more attention, and we've heard a lot of information today, and I think that it's been more clearly articulated to the commission than it ever has been, and I would certainly appreciate the opportunity not to take action as a commission on this today, but rather I would like to suggest that we be prepared to take that action at our next meeting next Friday.
We could certainly do that. You know, if there's any amendments or proposals or whatever, you know, that would certainly be in order. I think for convenience sake, I'll ask staff this, does it make any sense just to roll the bills as we have them into one, so at least we've got one document to work off of instead of multiple documents? Mr. Martin, does that make sense?
Members, we can do an unofficial engrossment of the three bills as you've you have amended two of them, so we would include those two amendments.
Okay. I might suggest we might just, you know, roll all three bills into one, so we've got at least got one thing we're working out of, not three different documents.
So moved.
Okay. So Representative Thiessen moves that Senate file 2499, House file 2953 as amended, and Senate file 2631, House file 2999 as amended, be incorporated into Senate file 2573. And all we're doing is merging the bills. We're not adopting the policy yet. So is there a discussion on that motion? Hearing none of those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Okay. I'm sorry. Motion prevails. Okay, so now we will have one document. Does the commission wish to do anything further today? Do you want to mull it over further in the next week? As I say, we still have two other funds and some other minor issues, other issues to take up next week, and then look at the overall bill that we've been working on since last June, and then that's, I think that's about all the time I'm going to have meetings. Representative Kahn.
I think Senator Lynch's proposal was a good proposal, particularly now that we've rolled them together and we'll have an endorsement to not do it today.
Yeah,
not
just take you want another week to think about it? And
I don't think I need it, but I think it's a good
okay.
idea.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. We've gotten a lot of information today, and if the funds, you know, come back with anything further, I mean, we can always reopen it, but if you don't want to take final action today, you know, we will be meeting next week. So, Representative Nelson.
Looking here on the document, Senate file 2672, does that need to be included in these also, or is that a separate?
Well, that was a separate issue, and of course
that was the 1.5%.
That's okay. Different from, I mean, PERA seemed neutral on that. But perhaps we could have that on the agenda next week, too. We've heard the testimony. You know, if the parties want to talk about it, come back. You know, I mean, it does lock in cost of living increases down the road, which was a different direction that PERA had. But why don't we kind of hold it out as a separate issue right now? And if next week it's the will of the commission to adopt it,